three, four, five versions of three. Maybe just run through the different options again. I mean, obviously, effectively under I mean, which is the one that you're proposing we look at, 3 and 3a? Okay.
Okay, 3 and 3a is merely the fourth 3 on page 10 split into 2.
Mm. Okay.
And you will note that that was the work done by the committee after this
study. Yeah, yeah. Are we happy, I mean, Dean, with the conditions, page 12, 3a? You know, how the principles now have become dealt with. Sound right? Yeah, the conditions for the lawful processing of personal information in general are the following. Ananda, do you think it's worked? I mean, I'm just wondering whether it shouldn't be a reverse thing of the following conditions must be complied with regard to the processing of personal information. Why do we not opt for that formulation?
I'm actually happy with it as it is. The thing, you know, these are the conditions, and if we set out in the bill, as you know, if you go to the part chapter 3, then that is the way it is set out there as well. So. This interpretation of the Act clause is just a, you know, sort of a summary and an explanation of how everything works. So I'm quite happy with it as it is at the moment. I would be happy with the inclusion of the starting off to say that it's the data subject's rights as we've.
I think we've got to deal with that now. Pity Mario is not here. Do you want to then just take us through this three-page document on data subject rights proposed options?
Chair, maybe just to return to your question again. Technically, Chair, we've got an interpretation of the Act provision, and we were very careful not to create substantive provisions in these. Otherwise, it's going to amount to nothing else than a duplication. Chair, the separate document that we forwarded to the committee members relates to the data subject rights, the proposed amendments. There are actually just two options, if I may take us back. The request was that those provisions dealing with data subject rights must be inserted at the front of the bill. However, on the first page then of our separate document, we try to indicate that it will amount to a reshuffling of the provisions of the relevant chapter and might also require a redrafting. But we didn't stop there. On page 2 at the bottom of thereof, we proposed an option 2. Now, if you look at our interpretation provision in the bill itself, then it can be easily swinged, Chair, to place the emphasis on data subject rights. However, I think it is important to note that our conditions for the lawful processing of personal information, the emphasis is on the responsible party, and that is how it was drafted. Maybe just to mention with regard to the first option, Chair, is that the request was based on the fact that the UK did a similar thing. But if you look at the UK carefully, you will find that they don't start off with data subject rights provisions. They start off with a provision that deals with the responsibilities of the responsible party, and then they refer to the annexure. So strictly speaking, everything in the annexure, in any event, is inserted before you get to the data subject rights, which, if I remember correctly, is clause 7 thereof. But as it may be, then on page 3, Chair, is the option 3 that we proposed in order to try and place the emphasis on the data subject rights. We still need to interrogate it a bit further on a technical side. There's still a few things that bothers us, but I think in general we have a fairly good idea of how a provision like this will work. And of course, it's inevitable that we will have to refer to, as we did in subclause 1, to the conditions for the lawful processing of personal information, and then also to make it subject to the relevant exclusions and exemptions. You will note, Chair, that paragraphs E to H, we inserted question marks. Because the only concern that we have at this stage is that as soon as we place the emphasis on the data subject rights, we will have to go on sort of a fishing expedition in terms of the bill to see which ones should be emphasized, in addition to the fact that you have the conditions that must be complied with. And that is mainly why we inserted those question marks. I'm going to ask Ananda just to maybe indicate to us, but strictly speaking, if I remember correctly, the other countries, if there is an emphasis on data subject rights, it's usually on the emphasis of access to your personal information, the correction of your personal information, and then also the right to object, etc. So things in the clause work fairly well up to a certain stage, and that is where we get to subclauses 3, 4, and 5. Now we're back at the character of a roadmap provision, to the extent that we feel that it's still important to try and explain how the provisions of the bill fit together. So the first part of the clause, we have our data subject rights with certain questions to be raised, whether we should insert or delete some of those rights. And then in 3 to 5, we fall back on our proposed roadmap provision in an attempt to explain the mechanics of the bill further. So, Chair, that in short is the option then for 3A as we have it on page 12 of the bill itself.
It's basically 3A with a new one slap on the
front. Yes, Chief.
Of what's there, the A to H, whether it covers everything. I mean, but effectively what you're saying is this is nothing new. You're summarizing what is in other parts of the Act. It's for ease of reading. Yeah. My difficulty is so look, let's come back to the content, the A to H, whether everything is covered, and we can add other things later. I'm still not happy with the whole structure issue. Let me just sort of explain why. You start with the definitions, fine. It's definitions and purpose. So you have clause 2, the purpose. Then chapter 2 is application provisions, which deals with application, interpretation, and exclusions. shouldn't purpose and application go together? I mean, don't they really, doesn't purpose fit under application? So that's a one broader structuring on the one hand. Then with what you've done to the 3A, and we'll I'm looking now at your 3A with the rights aspect as well. Do the rights and the interpretation belong in the same clause? Why did you opt for that and not a separate clause? I mean, 3A, 3B for the moment. It does help with the interpretation, you know, how you interpret it. So it is linked to interpretation. But are you not sticking two things together with some glue that's not necessarily that solid? And then last point, the heading interpretation of the Act. I don't know if that sums up what we're trying to do in your old 3A, because it is more of a roadmap, and it's a roadmap to only some of the sections of the Act, not all. Which the complex sections. So the issues relating to the regulator are not covered. They don't need to be covered. I'm not saying that they should be. I'm basically, in short, saying I'm happy with the contents of your old 3A or your new 3A 2-5. I've just got questions as to whether the heading interpretation is the correct heading. So that's my concerns in short. Doesn't purpose belong in this chapter? And effectively definitions, because purpose and interpretation, or purpose and what was the one before that, application, isn't there a bit of a grey line? And then specifically, is interpretation of the Act for 3A the way it was? Is interpretation the correct heading? And then lastly, should you combine the rights in an interpretation in the same section, the same clause?
Chair, I'm also going to ask Cesar to assist us here, but...
And I also have one to...
Sorry.
In fact, sorry, I didn't point to anyone, and I'm left to understand something. I don't know who between you are.
Okay. Chair, maybe to start with the last question first, because I think it will assist us in answering the remainder of your questions. We agree that it is debatable whether the heading of the clause should be an interpretation provision, especially if we refer to data subject rights. However, our main concern was that we viewed the usefulness of our, and if I may still call it the roadmap provision, merely to point out to the application of the provisions and not create substantive provisions. And the same applies to data subject rights. We can split the two. We can have a clause referring to interpretation of the Act and then a clause dealing with data subject rights. Our main concern is merely not to create or to insert substantive provisions here. The application of the Act and the purpose provisions, we are of the view that they cannot be combined. Traditionally, and I know about the white block at the medal ceremony, Chair, but our purpose of the Act is usually a provision that indicates to us what is intended with all the clauses in our bill, and is very closely associated with our preamble then, of course, and our a long title, but it is still to be regarded as an introductory provision, whereas the application of the Act specifically is a substantive provision indicating to us what the ambit of the provisions of the bill is. I think I...
Ananda, then, Cesar?
Yes, I agree with Henk. Insofar as the interpretation of the Act, I don't know if there's a better way to describe the roadmap. Maybe we can find another heading for that, but I think that is all that it should be. Whatever other name we get for it, roadmap or interpretation of the Act, that's fine, and I don't think Android is the data subject. Should actually be there, because we're doing with the data subjects in one exactly the same that we're doing with the conditions of lawful processing in two. So it should have almost been interpretation of the Act in A, rights of the data subject, conditions, this, that, and the other. So I would agree that shouldn't be included. I think we only included it there to put the emphasis on it, since that was what we tried to do. But I think putting it first already does that. So I wouldn't think that would be correct to insert that in there, because it gives the impression as though you're dealing with substantive rights there, and we're not.
I agree with Hank that the tuples and the application should not be combined together, because the tuples tells us what the Act seeks to achieve, as opposed to the application of the Act, which is a more substantive provision, which tells us what it applies to, and it gives us more substantive provisions on that.
First of all, actually, preliminary apologies for my late arrival on account of unforeseen and unbudgeted circumstances. Secondly, I think we have a little bit lost our way. I think we may just have lost our way in this roadmap. If I can backtrack the discussion, I think it arose out of two issues. The first was the confusion about principles and provisions, and the fact that there were certain provisions which purported to be in a different position from the rest of the provisions because they wanted to be principles to be implemented by the rest of the provisions. And I think the first corrective measure we require is, this is a law, put all the provisions in the same place. If there are principles that need to be elicited out of the provisions, limit the law to thou shalt do, thou shalt not do, if A, then B. So that's one aspect. And I think that's what we should do. Personally, I am strongly against anything that makes bad law. The second concern in this discussion was your concern, Mr. Chairman, that the law was not user-friendly. So you asked for a preliminary section which explains how the law works. And I raised a concern at the time, and I need to raise a concern now. We cannot have interpretative provisions. It's bad lawmaking to have a provision which says what the rest of the provisions are trying to do. If the law is right, drafted properly, each intention is elicited from the provisions themselves. And one complicates things which may become readable to the man on the street, but become incomprehensible to a lawyer or to a judge.
Helping us, Maria. Dean, have you got anything to say?
I think it's important that statutes should be comparable.
Yeah, I mean, look. Let's look at where we're trying to go. I think, Maria, maybe it would be useful if you drafted something, or are you referring us back to your old draft, which I didn't bring.
I would like to refer you, Mr. Chairman, if I can, to your original genial intuition when you first saw that bill, because then we overthink. What you told them, it's fine, just eliminate all the headings, and whatever it says principle, eliminate the headings.
Sure.
And if we do that, the original bill, I think, reads fine.
But you've still got a problem of what are they. So they have eliminated the headings of principle, but you've then still got a problem of what are they, and this is what this section tries to do.
The words are, I think, assuming to you, Mr. Chairman, that the words are sufficiently clear in each provision to identify what they are, because they say the regulator shall, the data subject shall not, the data processor shall. So they're all provisions that, even though cast in the even though intended to be principles are not really cast in the language of principle. They're not expressing an abstract aspiration. They are telling the way it ought to be. And read with it in context, I thought that the thing was holding together. I understood it fine when it was first, when I first read. The only problem I had was with the headings.
Yeah, look, I don't. We're not going back onto the principle or no principle debate. We've had that. But the problem is there needs to be some kind of explanation as to what are they and how do they apply. I mean, look, where I think we are is that we agree that this chapter is interpretive. Well, it's called application provisions. It's basically to make the bill easier to understand and to read for lawyers and lay people alike. And I think one of the initial reactions that everybody has to this bill is immense confusion when they first read it. Hence, some of the huge fears about what it's seeking to do. So this chapter is meant to try and address that. It's agreed that this chapter shouldn't contain anything new. So there's no problem with that. I think that I mean, just in terms of trying to make progress, the page 10 I think could go, because you've effectively just split. I think the split is correct between 3A. I think there seems to be general agreement that there's going to be a 3B. Coming in that the data subject rights come out into a separate section. There seems to be general agreement. You're not agreeing with that, Ananda?
I don't really agree with that, because then you're going to, it's the interpretation of the whole act that's being dealt with in 3A, and also the interpretation of how the rights of the data subjects work. So it's the same thing that we're doing with the data subject rights that we're doing with all of the rest of it. So if you put the data subject rights in a separate one, it will put more emphasis on it. I agree with that. But the thing is then, why is it now in a separate, what are you trying to achieve by that? Because you're just interpreting it the same way that you're interpreting the conditions, for instance.
You're trying to emphasize this bill is effectively about protecting the data subject's rights in the way everything is processed. So it may be an indirect way, but the concern, the bill is to address problems that people have with the way their personal information is processed. So I think the idea was a clause where somebody, a layperson, can see, okay, these are my rights. That clause is just a summary of what follows in the bill, but it's easier for them to read. And so I would think data subject rights, it obviously is linked to the conditions for processing, but I still see it as different. I don't know. Dean, you wanted the clause to help me.
Yeah. Not a lot turns on it for me. I'm sorry. I'm not that helpful.
Okay. What I want to say is okay, let's agree. 3 on page 10 and the top of page 11 comes out that it is better to divide it. So that will save space and things. Then, can you try an option of dividing? Okay, not in a way that grants anything to data subjects that's not there. It's still an interpretive provision. But where the person in the street can go to the Act and in one short section that's easy to find, they can sort of see what their rights are, as you've got it here of 3A1, without running into the problems that Ananda's expressing. I mean, I hear what you're saying with that.
Yeah.
Because I think your average person, layperson, not your lawyer or your judge, is going to get to clause 3A or whatever it would then become 4, and it's buried. And because it's an interpretive provision, it's not adding anything substantial. The whole purpose of this is to make it easy for them to read.
I mean, I don't want to be repeating myself, but remember when we went to England, the act was nowhere to be seen. The office of the regulator was filled with booklets with nice pictures in which rights, obligations, duties, procedures, forms, and anything else was explained very simply for simple people. And this is not what the act is. We need to have semantic solidity in writing a law. The rest is for the regulator to put out the booklet with the pretty pictures.
Sure, but I think it's not pretty pictures. You do need to have acts that are that are not for lawyers and judges alone. Obviously, that's important when it comes to interpretation, but you need to have laws that are easy for the public to understand. And my experience, if you take something, the recent experience, the Child Justice Act, which is not a particularly, I don't think it's anywhere near as complicated as an act as this one. It's phenomenal how difficult it is for people to follow it, whether it is prosecutors or lay people. So bear with us on this one. But let's try that. Let's see what it looks like. And then I think, can you look at whether the roadmap section, whether interpretation is the correct word?
It can only be interpretation unless you want to create a new category.
You see, the difficulty is it's not interpreting the whole act. That's the main problem.
That's the problem. You can't have an act in which it says introduction, premises, or foreword.
I don't know, but can you have a look at that? I don't know if we can take it any further.
Gee, maybe just as a matter of clarity then, our 3A on page 12, the emphasis is on the conditions for lawful processing, etc. Should we now insert an option where we have a 3A and a 3B, but with the emphasis or the provision as proposed in our option 2 in our separate document?
Mm. Yeah. It's basically, we'll just repeat it then, sir.
Yes. 3A will remain on page 12, and then we will insert on page 12 of the bill. And then we will insert an option where we split that provision in two, but then we use the provision that we have proposed in the separate document that was forwarded to the committee members with the heading data subject rights, proposed options.
No, the three-page document that is on the question of data subject rights. So the rest of 3A is the same on page 3, but clause 1 is new, and it's that clause that I'm asking that they look at separating out into a separate clause. Okay, Ananda.
Yes, I'm just looking at the Data Protection Act of the UK, and they've actually got a part 1 preliminary where they have the definitions, and then what they have a heading, Data Protection Principles, where they actually have their roadmap. References in this act is there, in this, and the principles are interpreted according to this and subject to this and that and the other, as much as we have in our roadmap. So I was just wondering whether we couldn't perhaps put this roadmap that we have with the first chapter rather than in the second chapter, and then have it headings, rights of data subjects, conditions, lawful processing,
sure,
etc.
Yeah, no, I think look at that and look at some of the more recent. I mean, with respect to some of the people who are here, I mean, the British Act is older. Maybe look at some of the more recent ones and see if they're more easier to read. I mean, I think everybody admitted the British one wasn't the easiest reading. Okay, can we then
if we go to 3A on the next document on the 3 page.
Yes, we've been doing it, Mario. It's a bit difficult when you.
I've been 20 minutes late. Don't let's not make it a condition of everything. So 3A has gone through.
Yes, 3A1 and being separated out from 3A2. Now we're going to look at 3A1.
Okay, so but are you satisfied that you know what E and F mean?
Now we're going to look at 3A1.
Okay, good. That's
okay. So, Henk, you'd summarize before, just take us then through the rights that are there. And again, Mario, the purpose of 3A1 is not to create anything, but to describe what is in the Act.
Thank you, Chair. CESA Clause 1, the introductory part, merely refers to the conditions for the lawful processing of personal information as is stipulated in subclause 2 thereof, and then also on page 12 of our draft bill. Then we try to focus from paragraphs A to H on more specific rights of the data subject. So generally speaking, in general, the data subject has the right to have his or her personal information processed in accordance with the conditions for the lawful processing of personal information. Paragraph A, and this is merely this, and I should emphasize, Chair, that this is not a order of merit with regard to the rights. It's merely chronological, starting with a reference to Section 10 or Clause 10. The data subject has then the right to object under certain circumstances to the processing of his or her personal information as provided for in Clause 10. Paragraph B, to be notified that a personal information about him or her or it is being collected as provided for in Clause 17A, or be notified that his or her personal information has been accessed or acquired by an authorized person as provided for in terms of Clause 21. Paragraph C deals with the question of access, and paragraph D with the question of correction. So paragraph C provides that the data subject has the right to inquire from a responsible party whether he or she holds personal information of that data subject and to request access as provided for in Clause 22, and in paragraph D, to request where necessary the correction of the personal information as provided for in Clause 23. Chair, then paragraphs E to H, we have the question marks. This is roughly in line with the emphasis being placed on data subject rights by other countries, the right to object, the right to have access, and then the right to correction, etc. So in paragraph E, and this is where we face the question, should we go through the bill and the conditions, etc., and identify each and every right? Paragraph E then provides that the data subject has the right to refuse to the processing of his or her personal information for the purpose of direct marketing by means of unsolicited electronic communications as provided for in Clause 66. Paragraph F, not to be subject to its decision that was based solely on the automated processing of his or her personal information. G, and this G and H deals with remedies, Chair. G, and it must be recognized, or should be recognized as a right, to submit a complaint to the regulator, and then H, to institute civil proceedings where the rights have been affected as provided for in Clauses 71 and 94, respectively. So that, in short, Chair, is what we have at this stage with regard to data subject rights.
Forgive me just for one second to read this as a lawyer. The headings are not relevant in the interpretation of the law if they depend from the objective meaning of words in the text, the standard is the statute of interpretation. Now, a data subject has the right. I would read this as providing rights. Rights are in Section 3 to a certain extent. My concern is in respect of E, and I accept in respect of F, and I accept the sentiments. But as the right not to be subject to a decision which is basically solely on the basis of the automated processing of his or her or its personal information. I don't know whether this doesn't go way too far, because we're constantly, lots of decisions are made automatically on the basis of on the information we provide. I mean, if somebody is looking at contacting people in a certain area. No, I know, but I don't think that clause 68, and that's what I was trying to pick up on my computer, is the same import. So I don't know whether it's been summarized correctly.
You know, 68 is subject to subsection 2, adopted by our amendments, no one may, but then adopted subject has the right not to be subject to decision, which is often legal consequences for him or her, or which affects him or her, or substantial decision, which is based solely on the basis in automated processing of personal information, provide a profile of certain aspects of his or her personal. Look, I don't know if we can because effectively we want to need to go through each of the clauses. I would suggest for where we are at the moment, 3A1 is an attempt to describe what is in the bill. We can maybe come back and look at the words, depending on what we find. The one thing that's different is that you've got heuristics, whereas the 68 is his or her. Whereas, so if you look at 68, it refers just to his or her. Whereas with the 3A1, you're stuck in heuristics with it. So that's what we need to look at. But I think, I don't know if we can take 3A1 much further at this point.
Yeah. But may I just indicate, Mario, to the referred division? An individual is entitled, where the processing by automatic use of personal data, of which that individual is the subject, for purposes of evaluating matters related to, for example, performance as well as credit, worthiness, and liability of conduct. And qualities, like it's qualities, sole basis for any decisions expecting him to be informed by the data control of the logic involved in that decision taking. Same stuff. For what it's worth.
Okay, can we move then? Do you want to take some exclusions?
Thank you, Chair. The first option under clause 4 is the option proposed by Dr. Ambrosini. You will note in paragraph C that we replaced the word state with the public body because that is more in line with our definitions, clause of interpretation. State is an incorrect term to use there. Option 1 under sub-clause C then is the option proposed by Dr. Ambrosini and Ms. Smith to have that paragraph deleted. Option 2, you will recall, is the option that we prepared in view of the comments that were submitted by the FIC. the, and maybe I could just mention there, Chair, or just highlight footnote 17 under that paragraph C. You will recall that the question was raised at the previous technical committee meeting whether it should be necessary to define terrorist and related activities. And it could be defined with regard to reference to Section 4 of the Protection of Constitutional Democracy Against Terrorist and Related Activities Act. However, our only concern is that it will most probably make that Roman 1 paragraph a bit convoluted. So if the committee feels strong that there is not a sufficient indication as to the meaning of terrorist and related activities, that we could possibly insert a definition then at the end of the exclusions provision. Paragraph D deals with the processing for journalistic purposes. You will recall, Chair, that the first option there was one of two proposals as a result of the discussions of the technical committee on the 8th and 9th of April. The option one is then merely an attempt to expand on the provisions of the existing D by trying to highlight the need for sufficient guidelines with regard to the processing of personal information. Option two is the option that aims to deal with a blanket exclusion in respect of journalistic, literary, or artistic material. Option three, proposed by Dr. Ambrosini, is self-explanatory. And then we have a fourth option, which is at the bottom of page 13, a proposed separate clause dealing with the exclusion for journalistic purposes. And you will recall that we have submitted this proposal to the committee as well. And the strike-throughs that you see there is based on the discussions that took place. And the proposal now is that we should insert then possibly a subclause 2 where we indicate that any time that there is a dispute in respect of whether adequate safeguards have been provided for in a code as required in terms of subclause 1, the regard may be had to the list of those issues referred to, and the subclause aims to provide us with more detail with what is meant with adequate safeguards. You will also recall that term was questioned by the technical committee at a previous stage, and the proposal is therefore to retain this this clause, but maybe with an attempt in subclause to explain or expand on what adequate safeguards are, and that is only in an event of a dispute arising.
Okay. Where is this dispute going to be had, and who is going to be adjudicated?
Yes, Chair. Chair, a dispute arising, if I claim that the Act does not apply to me and a data subject wishes to argue with me, I do not have any doubt in my mind that dispute will most probably be adjudicated in court.
Not the regulator.
Chair, that is debatable. as our bill is drafted at this stage, it remains open. If a data subject opts to submit a complaint to the regulator, he or she is free to do so. And then the ordinary investigative provisions of the regulator will kick in. But I think in order to get the dispute settled quickly, I think in all likelihood an application will be made to court.
Can we just deal with the easy stuff, which we'll call the more easy stuff, which is 4A to C. 4A to C. Okay, Dr. Ambrosini wanted his option 1, so if it remains there, it can go to 4C. The exclusion of state security matters. So that option 1 remains there. The ANC we wanted. Option 2 on the bottom of page 12. Do you want to put it as an option, or do you want to put it in? I mean, I don't think this is really going to be the brain to the action. This is the FIC stuff. Okay. So what I'm saying is, can we just remove the word option 2 at the bottom of page 12, which related to the FIC stuff, relates to C. Not C. Okay, yeah, it's relating to. You obviously. Let's put it this way. You, Dean and Mario don't want C at all. Okay, so you keep that as your option 1. Hank, do it this way. Take out your existing C as you've got there on page 12. If you can put in from the ANC side, we would go with the C on the top of page 13. Okay? So if you can put that in, and then Dean and Mario, do you want, the FIC concern, I know you don't want national security, would you be opposed to the whole thing, really? What it would be is the C on page 12 comes out. It gets replaced by the C on page, top of page 13, which includes what FIC wanted. And then your option, it remains then, delete the whole thing. Okay, we can agree on that. I would suggest then with definitions, you just made this point of that it should go to the end of clause 4. You can do that. It's not necessarily used once, so it's not necessarily put in the definition section. So you can find some way of some place to put it either in the definition section or at the end of the chapter. I think that's what usually happens when definitions are not used that often. So if we can then, can we go to D then, which is the journalist? I've got some points to make, but I don't know if you want to start.
Yes, just to say again that any provision, however worthy, which tries to deal with the idea of a code of ethics that is adequate as measured against the theory, is unacceptable to me, because the nature of journalistic activity is simply not comparable to the kind of condition we are in this law imposing upon processes of information media. It's a different kind of activity altogether, and therefore no attempt is going to succeed, and therefore I remain committed to the option 2 by any person of journalistic literary or artistic material.
Can I maybe come in from
the ANC side as to where our thinking is at this stage going? I mean, from the level of our justice study group. Exclusions are not covered by the bill at all, so they're out of it. So you need them, but you at the same time don't want them to become an excuse to fit lots of things in, to basically circumvent the bill. So, for example, we agree with the issue of literary or artistic material being an exclusion, but we don't want a situation where somebody is processing personal information and then is able to say no, this is literary, when it's quite clearly not. How does that get resolved? So our suggestion is to say, what we'd want to do is separate out literary or artistic from journalistic, because it should theoretically be easier. We have a clause which you didn't have before, excluding literary or artistic material. but you maybe put in a but we want some kind of qualification of it in the event of disputes. So what we were suggesting is having bona fide, and you leave it to the regulator to determine what is bona fide or not in the event of a dispute. So you don't want to stop people publishing unauthorized biographies or whatever else, or artistic is extremely wide, but you do want some kind of dispute resolution mechanism, which is preferably not the courts as the first instance. I mean, the courts, one, we're not ousting the courts, but one can go to the courts later. And that we would see as being the regulator. So the principles of what we're trying to say as ANC is exclude, have an exclusion for literary or artistic material, but have some way of policing the grey area, where quite clearly this processing of information is not being done for literary purposes, although the person is claiming that to escape from the provisions of the Act. So that's why the suggestion was, and it's just a suggestion, would be bona fide literary artistic, and the regulator to determine what's bona fide or not. Do you want to have responses on that, then Dean, or Mario first, then Dean?
Mr. Chairman, through the millennia, censors of all types have claimed to determine what is artistic and what is not artistic, from the Catholic Church in respect of Michelangelo's Bird's Corridors, or the censorship on Verdi, or pornography. And I don't think we should be the latest chapter of that horrendous page of human history. I'm sure that you don't want to be remembered as a censor. The issue, that's one aspect. The other aspect, I do not believe in the practice of making laws which are all comprehensive and then letting the Constitutional Court creating the exemptions. I mean, I think we should take the issue upon ourselves. The third aspect, which I stated quite often, is that if we need to err, let's err on the side of freedom. If then it gets abused, we can always get a second bite at amending the Act and tightening it up, but it becomes difficult to loosen up an Act once it's been made too tight. I don't believe that it is an issue that we should define bona fide or mala fide artistic, because who is to decide what is bona fide? I mean, I never looked at Picasso as being art, and if somebody asked me whether it was bona fide art, I would have thrown it out of any gallery, but people always feel different. I think we should, let's stand by the Constitution. Anything which is the exercise of a constitutional right, including journalistic expressions, should be exempted. Because there is freedom of speech, there is freedom of
but can I just come in?
Of expression.
I mean, the Constitution, we have a Bill of Rights with a whole lot of rights. Most, if not all, of those rights have to be balanced against other rights. So if you have your clause as you want it, for the purpose of embedding the exercise of a right protected under the Constitution, you make the bill meaningless, okay? Because there is a right of freedom of expression, but it is balanced against other rights, such as the right of privacy. No, just let me finish, okay? So that's the difficulty with that approach. So we'll keep in your option three, but your option three is unworkable. And, I mean, Dean, you wanted to respond. I think the difficulty we've got is we want to protect literary or artistic material, but we don't want it to become an archway to circumvent the bill. We do not want to be censoring and defining. I mean, obviously, Picasso is art, and anything else that's stuck on a canvas or whatever, it's the purpose also that becomes important. So it's wide, anything, but one just doesn't want some data processor to try and circumvent the Act by arguing that this is art, whereas in fact they're processing and making money out of processing personal information and selling it as art. So that's basically the concern.
Example of something we're all subjected to, cartoons. I mean, a good cartoon will...
Mario, cartoons are art. No questions asked.
Well,
It's a question of the purpose of the act is to stop the processing of personal information, mainly for commercial ends. Because, I mean, the way the act works is... It's not a privacy act, okay? You can publish anything you like. It only really kicks in if there's a complaint, okay? It's wrong to see the act as a protection of privacy act. It's an issue relating, as in the long title, to the way personal information is processed. So people can make their cartoons or whatever. It's a question, though, of some person trying to be clever by selling personal information databases as art. It's more a purpose related thing. But I don't know. I've got Ananda, but Dean, you next.
Yeah, I have my number in the one. Just to agree with you, that Mario, your proposal of any purpose embodying the exercise of a right protected under the Constitution is simply too wide. Because those purposes would then include your political rights, which we are dealing with differently, under the sensitive personal information, your rights to appear in the legal religion, which we are dealing with differently. So you can't have this massive exclusion. But as to the free speech, there remains to me a complete difference between the collecting and the collation of data for commercial purposes and the writing of blogs, newspapers, magazines, books, and the like. They are simply not comparable. And when the ANC considers again, just be very careful that you don't end up in a situation where you start practicing prior restraint, and you have an administrative body here that's going to start adjudicating content.
It's a question of trying to find some way of dealing with it, because it's commercial is not the test. You write a unauthorized biography, you want to make money out of that unauthorized biography. So fine, we don't want to stop that, okay? But the concern would be over a whole lot of personal information on whoever, any group of people, being sold on the basis that this is literary material.
But I think that should go to court, you see, because the common law has to be developed.
Yeah.
Much as it has already been developed for defamation, your rights of reputation. These are also personality rights, their privacy of a specific kind. And if they need developers, people must do that.
Yeah, but is it not, given that you're going to have the regulator, which is going to build up expertise as far as what is legitimate, what is not legitimate, would they not be the first port of call? And you only invoke the regulator when there's a dispute. So it's not as if they, I mean, people do, you know, people produce art the whole time. The regulator only gets invoked if there's a dispute about it.
The
so it's not as if they...
No. The kind of judgment call you're acquiring from this gentleman or lady is completely different.
Regulators are collective.
Judgment call they will be making in respect of all the other forms of alleged infringement of breaches, of conditions, of breaches, of privacy. It's a different kind of animal. It can't work. And don't forget the UK commissioner told us they never have, and they don't think they ever will, deal with their particular provisions, which are also pretty much like what you described, the bona fide attempt, the reasonable belief that they are in compliance with the relevant conditions. They never have, and they don't think they ever will.
Okay, Hank, sir, I've got Ananda, who's now looking sad that I haven't pointed at her, and then I've got Hank.
I was just thinking the E-Directive simply says that you can have the exemption to the extent that it is necessary to reconcile the right to privacy with the rules governing freedom of expression. So can't you say that you're excluding it to the extent that it is necessary to reconcile the right to privacy with the rules governing freedom of expression? then you actually pass the buck. But it's going to be then to have to be decided. Well, it will then be just in accordance with the current position regarding the balancing of the two rights in terms of the Constitution.
Just to attempt to give a direct answer to the concern raised by Ms. Smuts, I think one should just think what will happen practically. And we appreciate the concern about prior restraint. But one should take into consideration if a data subject approaches the regulator, the first question that regulator will... may I use an example? Let's say ABC newspaper published something about a data subject. That data subject goes to the regulator. The first question that the regulator will have to decide before even considering the merits of the case is whether the Act applies or not. Not with regard to the specific article, but with regard to the profession as embodied by ABC newspaper. You will be guided by Clause 4. Only then, if a decision is made that under it's fairly obvious. If you're ABC newspaper and you're subject to a code, I cannot see.
You're talking about going up to journalists now.
Yes.
You asked where was I want to settle the literary and artistic first.
I apologize.
Okay. Look, also the issue is and I suppose one has to bring in the newspapers, unfortunately now. Where does these issues relating to how much is the regulator going to be involved with publication of any material? Because that's usually going to be one stop. And the powers are basically get the regulator to issue an order to say stop. But the thing has already been written. Okay? So your remedy would be defamation in any of this literary, artistic, journalistic.
Or breach of privacy.
But
which is unrelated.
Yeah, but as I said, it's not, I don't see this as, it goes on to Mario's point from last time, having a privacy clause. I don't actually see this as a privacy
absolutely
act.
I agree with you.
But look, I don't know, I've raised, it's sort of new stuff, as it were. I think Tan to Henk and Ananda particularly. Can you look at, I think you've heard, you've got Mario's option 4 covers, option 3 rather covers everything. That's the one about the exclusion of anything done for any purpose, embodying exercise of the right to take down.
Yeah.
So that covers everything. From the ANC side, if you could look at some kind of drafting to exclude things done for literary or artistic purposes, you've got material, purposes would be the better object, the better word. But to look at whether the regulator could be a body that deals with disputes, and it would really be cases where, given that the powers of the regulator come afterwards, I can't see it being prior restraint. Okay. It would be more that they keep releasing this information and they say it is literary.
Would you consider that book in which one political leader named the names of three persons as HIV positive?
The book was published, the remedy was followed.
So it's got
it is private information. Let's take Katra Semenya and the information relating to the gender space.
Yeah, that's not the book.
That's not the book, no.
Right, that's not a book.
But what one wants to stop is effectively the sale of personal information that means that you're you get hounded by people trying to sell you stuff.
With publication, whether it's
okay to be journalistic. Okay, we'll get on to journalistic now.
Okay, we're not doing it.
and the idea of making the adjudicator the regulator and
Can they look at it? If you look at the law defamation, whether it's journalism or to a certain extent literary or artistic purposes, there is a balancing act between public interest and defamation. There is not in point of, of privacy, but it's in point of remedies. If the defending act action is not sufficiently negligent, there is no gross negligence, there is no malice, a defending action is condoned. That's basically is the law of defamation. What does that mean? That means that the public interest overrides your much stronger interest in the hierarchy of interest of not being defamed. Something said about you as a public figure, which is false, but is said without gross negligence, with simple negligence. And there is nothing you can do, there is nothing I can do, because the public interest to be informed overrides. Now, in the situation of privacy, we're dealing with information which is true and correct. It's just private. So the public interest, by definition, whatever gets publicized, whatever goes into the newspaper, they do it because there is a public interest. They're not going to write of obscure people, of obscure information. So I don't see how we can have anything but a blanket exemption of the entire field. Point number one. Point number two. One of the cornerstones of freedom of press is freedom from any review of content, number one, and the other one is freedom from registration. The press doesn't need to be registered. I can start a newspaper here and now, distribute to everyone, and that's my freedom.
No licensing.
It's an extension of the right of communication. As I write a letter, I can write the same letter to everyone and call it a newsletter. Or newspaper. Now, let us not introduce a requirement from for registration through the window by means of a code of conduct. If we have a series of provisions that basically says you can't do it, however, if you are subscribed to a code of conduct, then you can do it. You have effectively a registration requirement, which we can't have.
Agreed.
Yeah, looking at the media, I mean, our issue as ANC is we do not want to get involved in restricting journalist activity, but it's a similar concern of not wanting that to become an excuse to subvert the act. So we quite liked the original provisions of let them self-regulate. What we felt is we should actually engage further with SANEF on the matter. And not to try and settle it here, but to actually engage SANEF where we can come with our concerns and they can come with theirs. So the issue is not trying to, we definitely do not want to curtail them, but we just don't want it, as with the literary and artistic material, to become a mechanism for subventing the purposes of the Act. We're not interested in journalists and what they write. Those as far as this Act is concerned, that's to be covered elsewhere. No, but we could say as the committee, I mean, or the full committee probably, in fact, I would like the chairperson to be present as well, so we can let you know of that meeting, and I think can we then leave the rest of the journalistic provisions to after that engagement. That engagement would probably be during the recess, so-called recess. Cheers. Okay. Sure. Well, I don't. Yeah. Okay. All right. Can we then move? you've done away with savings in 5 and 6. Can you go back there?
Clause 5, the content thereof was referred to or included, inserted on the request of the technical committee in clause 3, the application of the Act.
Okay.
And you will find it in 3A and B.
All right, then we get on to chapter 3. Should we, what time is lunch? 1. We started at 9, it's coming up half past 10. When do you want a tea break? We're going to need breaks, and I'm surprised that you're not smoking anymore. I would have thought you... Sorry, we got the Western. Well, I mean, we could go for another half hour, but it might be... It might just be at this point to have a short break, like 10 minutes. Agreed? Okay, so then we'll start with the conditions. 10 minutes then.
So weird because I've seen you the Friday, then I spoke to a friend of mine the Tuesday at the end. Just after the blue, I had spoken to Leanne, and she was just speaking to Leanne. Leanne speaking for my details, and then I was like, wow, I'm speaking about Leanne on Friday. And then we got in touch on email the Wednesday, and I said, I ran into you, and you said, what's up? And she said, okay, cool, what are you doing? But no, she's fine.
Which division of which law?
She's a conveyancer.
Conveyancer, okay.
She's in the property department. Yeah, I think she actually did. She started her articles in the department. So she's a little
ENS,
she obviously is enjoying it.
Yeah, I was thinking for a moment that at ENS they don't reach insurance.
Yeah, and they don't rotate you off.
I'm staying away then. Because I want to sort of like, you know, know the ins and outs, you know the hassles, especially the hassles. Okay, this is all back in this area of law, you know, and then just to find out, because obviously when you're at varsity, you know, certain content stimulates, you know, but then when you're there, practically, it's different. So I just want to be aware of the
Yeah. The tech is quite good with translating people. Even the smaller firms can translate people.
Yeah.
They sort of can give you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have family?
Yeah, in Paul.
In Paul. Oh,
but I'm staying in Australia.
Yeah,
so.
It's too far. But yeah. You're enjoying Cape Town. Oh, this is Cape Town. Probably it's hot in Germany.
Yeah, that's really nice over there. I see you guys are coming with the rain.
Now. Yeah, you know how it is. You know, but
yeah.
I still love Cape Town.
You haven't thought of moving
up? I know, obviously, if you're black and you want to make your way up in the legal world, But I have been reading that there is a trend now to try and attract black executives in Cape Town. And what we realize that it's not just like financially, people, it's not such a draw card anymore. They need to also look at the social motivation. That's what they're trying to do now. Obviously, I'm happy. So it's not just a matter of, yeah. So I'm happy here. I'm comfortable. Yeah. But
well,
hey, you never know.
The opportunities come and you go.
Exactly. You never know, but preferably commercial law.
When are you finishing your studies?
2 years. Because I like. I mean, I after UCT, I went to my BA, and after my BA, my visa, and stopped working, trying to get money, and then after that, but now I'm looking at the next year. But then I still have to do a master's. Remember, I told you that I'll do it at UCT and then have that year at the School of Legal Practice. So I'm happy about that because they have, you can do the master's and the year together.
What do you want to do?
Commercial law, but you know what, to be honest with you, hey, like the philosophical, like just reading, that really inspires me, but you're not going to make much money with that.
Yeah.
So, but that really stimulates me, I really love all that stuff, but commercial law.
The thing with the that you say interesting, but if you're not, that's like you're gone. Well, maybe you think that's going to become a judge or something. That's very interesting.
No, yeah, it seems like you're going to become a judge.
You just think, like, you think differently about these issues as well.
Yeah, but I don't want to be a judge.
Or if you're going to write books and stuff, like academia.
Yeah, that's if, yeah, you know, and you're not going to make much money with that. And I am chasing the money. I'm chasing the dough. And
I think they do make money. They just look like they don't make money. It's not like
they don't buy expensive cars.
Yeah, and I think if you write a book, you can probably get over $1 million for that book, you know.
Yeah, but it takes a long time.
If you write a couple of articles, you can get. I mean, I know I was doing research last year.
Mm-hmm.
These guys were getting like $50,000 for that article, and it was like 10 pages, like hello, 50,000 for 10 pages.
For like journals,
yeah.
Like
yeah. For those kinds of things. But there's so many institutes that do, you know, chapters in books that we don't even know about, that I wasn't even aware of at UCT. It's like these international think tanks that, you know, want issues on piracy.
Okay, yeah,
So there's a lot of scope to make a lot of money. I think it's something you should probably do on the side and not as a main.
Yeah, I'll see. You know, you always have this idea that this is where you want to end up, this is what you want to do. But then as you go along, opportunities come up and so I'll just have to see.
Yeah.
But the main thing is just what you need. Okay, maybe not this one.
Terrible.
No, but the thing is, you know, especially, I mean, if you can't do the proper thing, it's really baffling me. Because, like, I was sitting at a protection of information so they just chucked me there. I mean, the one for the NIANC was the state pension consultant. So when I went on the internet to check up the salary, the salary was between 400 and up to
400.
That's
a lot.
Exactly. How much? It's a lot. It's a lot. And you know, like with me, I prefer when, for example, debate on that. Maybe it's because I'm just coming from a legal background and also a political one. I prefer them to be settled in terms of what so then they'd have this debate, and then the principal political advisor comes up. Something in she's going to say something on that, you know, the law is like this, and then court a case, and then, you know, come there. No. And eventually,
that's the lawyers.
Yeah, principal political advisor. No, actually, LLB, I checked that.
LLB,
and they also, I mean, in one, they were asking for a principal state law advisor in KZN provincially, and they were like, you have to be an advocate, you have to have practiced 5 years public law. And I'm like, oh, which I can do? And they're like, my, going with a provincial advisor. And the salary was something like $800,000. No, no way. But seriously, man, I'm so serious. I just, the government, I don't know why they go. And that's one of the problems with the NPA. Whatever control, especially commercial
I mean, I'm just amazed. I remember when the Competition Amendment Act, I don't know if you were elected back in those, it was 2008, I think.
Mm.
But there was all these like constitutional issues with the bill, right?
Mm.
Then it went through to the president. Mm. And then they said, no, that's a dilemma. Not trying it, they are constitutional. We sent it back to Parliament. They look at it, they're like, this is now in your transcript of what happened. Then they're like, yes, the president has raised these constitutional issues with this bill, but we don't agree, we're passing on it. Then it goes to Zuma and he signs the bill, and he's like, look, fine. I mean, the people in Parliament. This is a massive act. Competition law is big, you know, for like economics and the
government.
And they come in and interrogate the constitutionality of the thing. They just said, no, this is fine. Why? There's conflicting opinions, but we'll just ignore what the president says. And the problem with that is, if you take something to court, the court's going to say no, but the president, he will supervise the parliamentary process. So whatever he deems to be unfair, he's going to, you know, refer it back to him. So in theory, that's the mechanism that needs to, you know, be like account for what happens in parliament. But in practice, the parliament is going to ignore what the president says and just be like, look, we don't actually think this is a big deal. We'll send it back to them, it's fine. We think it's fine. And everyone passed the ball. Now they want to take it to court again.
The ball.
The president decided. Now this is just the same problems that were raised in parliament. Now they think they're not taking it to
court. Really and then in my mind, I'm like, wow, you know what? Maybe I should just be lazy. Just sort of slip in the public law, and just make us a little bit more sure. But at the same time, like, it's not really challenging. I don't know, but also to just keep abreast of things, because now if you look at you, like you guys in the private sector, now you're sending you here, you know, and, but because when you're here, you know what's happening.
Yeah.
You know what's happening, because it all starts here.
But there's an increasing sort of merging of the private and the public. It's not as separate.
It's not as separate anymore.
Maybe you think it was, because a lot of the stuff was that the corporate and investment banking is doing, they impacted by this. They impacted
reconvening
state liability bills. They impacted by a lot of like public law things. You wouldn't think it at all. You just think they do deals and they, you know.
Yeah.
But it's they, so it's good to have this kind of, so your kind of public law thing, and you can take it to a commercial place. Very useful.
All right, Hing, chapter 3.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, it might be a bit monotonous at this stage to go through all the proposed amendments. I think generally they are self-explanatory with regard to Clause 7. There's only a consequential amendments inserted there. You will also note that the heading to that part, we also had to affect certain amendments to bring it in line with the conditions and to delete or omit reference to principles. With regard to the processing limitation, Clause 8, we do not have anything there except footnote 23, where the question is merely raised whether the word unnecessarily should be inserted at the end of paragraph B to highlight the notion that some degree of prima facie infringement is permissible. So that is just a question that we raised there.
Do you want to just stop on that one? I mean, that seems to make sense. I don't know how it fits in with other jurisdictions, but I mean, obviously, any form of processing probably would infringe the privacy, so having unnecessarily, I suppose there's the reasonable manner, but I don't know, Ananda, what's your...
You know, we did have the word unnecessary in, and somewhere along the line somebody argued that if you say it in a reasonable manner, that's unnecessary to have unnecessarily, so, but, you know, it was taken out, but I wouldn't mind having it back again. So.
Yeah, can we put? Should we put it back in? Okay. Hank, then.
Chair, the chair of clause 9. No proposed amendments, except for we have the option proposed by Dr. Ambassini with regard to the omission of clause 9 and the replacement thereof with a clause dealing with the right to privacy.
Can you just stop there? Are you happy with it? The wording.
Yes, thank you. Now, if you can delete, because it was part of other amendments I've made, the words irrespective of whether such information is used or meant to be used in trade or commerce on the public domain or in a similar different format, I think we can eliminate that last sentence.
Okay. So you'd keep it then as an option. So you'd have 9 minimality and then option... option 1 or option right to privacy.
Thank you, Chair.
The process is simple and elegant.
Thank you. Chair, clause 10, no amendments.
Just going back to Dr. Ambassini's clause, is the heading the right one?
Yeah.
Look, I mean, maybe I don't want to start having sub options. I mean, he's happy with it, so leave it as it is. I'm not against the clause, but I'm not sure whether right to privacy is the right heading for it. I would have thought minimality is the right heading. Yes, but let's leave it. Let's not have that debate now. But just to tag it or for people to know the intentions.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, under clause 10, there's no proposed amendments at this stage, but I think we would like to possibly just flag 10.1a at this stage and have a look whether we would require any consequential amendments as a result of our clause 25, which deals with the special personal information of children. But I think it might be better for us just to once again go through that clause a bit later on and then possibly... just see whether it does have a direct impact on this clause. Clause 11, we have the proposed amendment under 11 2D Roman 2, which was also the proposal by the FIC. You will recall that, and you can see there the omissions there that the wording to comply with an obligation imposed by law was a separate subparagraph, but the two paragraphs, the one dealing with the obligation in law and the one with SAR, was on instruction combined into one subparagraph. clause 12, the collection for a specific purpose. The instruction was that clause 13 and clause 12 should be collapsed, and that was done. I don't think there's anything specifically to highlight there at this stage. Under clause 14, Chair, you will note that there is another option proposed by Dr. Ambrosini, and it is reflected there. There was just, when I went through it again, there was just one small error that I can't immediately see, but we will correct it. It's merely a question of, and it, I think it was on our side, we apologize for that, copying it, a little mistake slipped in, but it's a, just a word or a letter somewhere, I can't pick it up now.
Did you see the initial submissions? It was IT Governance Network and ASISA. Because on the IT Governance Network, under Dr. Ambrosini's option one, they wanted an addition of not processed for any other purpose or used in support of measures or decisions regarding any particular individual's right to protect the individual's right. Did you look at that at all or not?
We only recently received the submissions. We went through them cursory. We didn't have the opportunity to study them in depth. I think what we can propose at this stage is we can always insert our response by way of footnotes, if it is appropriate with you, in a following version of the document. I don't know whether Amanda would like to add something at this stage.
We did actually go through them, but I thought that the options it was referring to Dr. Ambrosini's options, he should actually be the one to indicate whether he would like to include it or not.
Ambrosini, did you see the documentation?
Yes, I appreciate reflecting my options. What I did, I redrafted the bill, so all my amendments come together. This addition to 11 was for the purpose it works together with the elimination of the exemption on the side of the state. So it was the C exemption, the deletion of the C under 4. So if we go that route of not exempting the state, this is a place in which the state must have the authority over collecting information. And I was thinking, but think about the movement control system of the Department of Home Affairs, in which information is taken directly from the data subject. And you give them their passport and they scan it, and they take in automatically all your information, date of birth, issuance of the passport, etc. So if that goes, this would be a rectification to the overall otherwise sweeping effect of the non-exemption of the state.
I know you don't want any, but even the way it is at the moment is involving, it's limited to involving national security and for purposes of prevention, detection of crime. So I don't think Home Affairs would be, even on that, exempt, and would have to put in place data protection measures. SARS, same thing.
This doesn't affect the processing. The processing still needs to be in compliance with the data protection measures. This is the provision which refers to collecting directly from the data subject.
So I'm lost. What are you saying about the wanting the IT governance
amendments.
I mean, you can you can take it out. I mean, I think it would, if another law creates a state function based on the collection of information, you have a conflict of laws, which is either going to be resolved in terms of a speciality and generality, or in terms of which one came first. This would save the other laws, if that's intention. Otherwise, just get rid of it. I don't have a great interest in it.
Any more comments from Mr. Lau?
Yeah. Do you want to make any comment on those?
At the moment, no.
No. I was just. I'm not sure how you're lost. I mean, we're looking at. You've got your submission.
Yes, I have.
Yeah, and so we're going through in clause 14, which is the one you had on the addition under option one. Mark, what? Yeah.
14.
Well, that's what I was trying to read it to understand.
How are you chairing this meeting, Mr. Chairman, if you don't call me to order?
I don't.
I need to ask the speaker to take 10 rands off your salary next month. Okay,
yeah.
Well, then let me speak to what it is that you want me to speak to, which is much more important. Okay, and you're not going to like this, Mr. Chairman, so give me some flexibility. On these data banks, remember that the notion of processing includes holding and carries the obligation that if you don't use it, you lose it. If you don't have an actual purpose in keeping things, you need to get rid of it. You can't run archive just for the pleasure of having archive if you don't have a purpose. People like me who keep information just in case you may need them. You need to get rid of them. Now, the notion that I'm suggesting here is to create an exception or a special dispensation for a data bank, which is a closed box. So for as long as the information, when it goes into the box, complies with the Act, when it comes out of the box, complies with the Act, and while it is in the box, is...
You explained why you wanted it last time.
Yes.
We're not evaluating whether that option should be there or not.
No, I didn't.
Sorry?
I never spoke to this before.
You did. You gave us a long input on the data banks, and I think there's a lot of validity there.
It must have been about something else that you...
No, it was about data banks. Dean, do you remember? Christine remembers. Yeah. Yes. Now it's a question, Mario. So I mean, we're not debating whether to keep this clause in or
okay,
out.
Okay, so what
stays as an option.
What I
wanted to know was IT governance... are proposing an additional amendment to your clause, which is, have you got their submission?
No.
It's on the second page of their submission. It says section 14, which is, we're dealing with clause 14, option 1, that's your clause, and then there's the wording. Other or used in support of measures or decisions regarding any particular individual.
It's not processed for any other purpose, no? Or used in support of measures or decisions regarding any particular individual.
It would be a 3 that gets stuck on at the end. So I'm asking your comment just on that one, not on the motivation for the whole point, the whole data bank issue.
So it's not processed for any other purpose than, comma, or used in support of measures or decisions.
So you've got these provisos.
No, I understand. I'm just trying to understand what it is that perhaps they can speak to it.
They were, okay, Mark, well, not yours, but you've engaged with it.
Mr. Chairman, I think that, first of all, obviously part of what Dr. Ambrosini has proposed is that there is a code of conduct. And probably that code of conduct would incorporate this, but I see no harm in the provision that has been proposed. it does make it clear that the information is being retained purely for the purposes of retention and not actually for any other purpose. But I think that the issue really for me was, is Dr. Ambrosini's option going to be accepted, or are we, that's one of the first issues obviously. If it is going to be accepted, then I would propose that we do put in the clause which is proposed by IT governance.
I can't answer that. It's there because it's being looked at.
Yeah.
So if it wasn't going to be looked at, it wouldn't be there. I think it's got, I think there are valid points raised about data banks.
I understand what it means. What I think, if I understand correctly, if a data bank relates to information relating to a single individual only, ain't a data bank. Is that the concept? So if I run a data bank about anything you can find about John Jeffrey, and I get, that's not a data bank, no matter what. And I think, I don't have a problem. Unless one runs a data bank for historical purposes or whatnot about a public figure. I could run a data bank about President Mbeki or President Mandela, why they are alive, with all the information available. It's always very difficult because these things come and bite you where you don't mean to.
Yeah, what's the definition? Did you give us the definition of data bank? No, it's not being put into Henker's list. Did you put it in my option as well?
No.
Because I think if this option said we looked at the needs of the definition of data bank, so that's the definition in the
The copy that I have of 12 March doesn't actually have a definition of data bank, so I think.
No, I'm saying that's because, in terms of what IT governance network. Dr. Ambrosini was talking about these sort of general data banks, so maybe we can delve into it in terms of the data banks. If it is collecting all the news clippings of particular individuals for research purposes, I know we're dealing with research elsewhere, just the section lists. No, but it keeps the material. So it keeps.
So it will not fall under the definition of research.
Okay, yeah.
Because they keep it. Yeah. And then when the input number is in the program, while the surface is not clear, the key is because it's not applied.
Yeah. But I think the problem with then what IT governments are wanting, if you have then, does link to the definition of the data bank, you do keep. Data file with all the news clips on a particular individual. That is specific individual.
I think we're passing the fact. We recognize that there is need for something like this. We're passing the fact to the regulator because we're not this over strong. So I think that the regulator needs a higher willingness to use this data to deal with this problem.
Yeah, but we're talking about whether the amendment, the new 3,
on consideration, it seems that it doesn't add much because if it becomes a concern, it will be addressed by the regulator on the code of conduct. And why not preventing just the collection of information about a specific person. And the information is not going to be collected about an obscure person. We're talking about people that is worth collecting information about. So again, if somebody collects information about someone, there is a measure of public interest behind.
But look, I think it's your option. But I would have thought that the protection would be the code of conduct, and I'm not quite sure of the unintended consequences of the amendments that IT governance are proposing to clause 14. So I would suggest that it doesn't get included. But that's on your behalf, Mario. It's your clause. Do you agree with that? Yes. Okay. All right. Dealt with. All right. Hank.
Thank you, Jim. Clause 15, the first proposed amendment was discussed at the meeting previously on the 21st, that is in subclause 3, introductory wording. Paragraph B, there's also an amendment that was already approved and requested by the technical committee. And then subclause 3C, once again, is the FIC amendment. Clause 16, there are no amendments, Chair. Clause 17, you will recall that the committee requested us to split that provision into two in order to differentiate between the requirement for the notification to the regulator and then also to the data subject. And in 17A, it's merely the provisions copied from the existing clause 17 with the addition under 17A4C2, where we once again find the words to comply with an obligation imposed by law, emanating from the FIC proposal. Clause 18 at the top of page 20, there are no amendments, as well as clauses 19 to 21. Data subject participation, a very minor amendment in clause 22B, Roman 2, where the comments that we received indicated that the wording that is not excessive is to a certain extent redundant and not necessary to be inserted as a requirement. Clause 23 and 24, no proposed amendments, Mr. Chair. And then it brings us to part B, the processing of personal information, special personal information. And then now under clause 25, we have our proposed amendments that was also discussed by the committee on the 21st of May, where we had a separate document where the discussions took place and we brought our instructions in here. Clause 25, 1 and 2 aims to draw a distinction between the information of a child and then sub 2, the special information of a data subject who is not a child. Mr. Chair, you will recall that we, or the committee, expressed its concern with regard to the use of the term parental consent or parental control. So in subclause 1A, we propose that instead of defining the term child, except for what is in clause 1, we aimed to replace the wording parental control with what is proposed there now. The clause reads, a responsible party may, subject to section 25A, not process personal information concerning a child under any circumstances where that child is legally incompetent without the assistance of a competent person to take any action or decision in respect of any matter concerning the child. Possibly we can just replace the words the child with him or her. And then in paragraph B, we aim to provide an indication of what a competent person should be regarded as. So I don't know, maybe we could just possibly pause the...
I'm not happy with this, because I don't think he addresses the concern we, I think we all jointly expressed. However you cut it, a legally competent person for the overwhelming purposes of law is an 18-year-old. Okay, how do we...
Chief, can I maybe immediately respond to that? Generally speaking, the age of majority is 18. what we try to refer to here, legally incompetent, does not strictly relate to the age of majority. The example usually used is the Termination of Pregnancies Act, where a female person who is 16 yes. years old, so she will be legally competent to transact.
I understand that this is example. The legal competence is 18. That's the rule. The exceptions, which are provided in several laws, there is sexual competence at the age of 14. There is a competence to give consent for purposes of abortion at the age of 16. And there are another bunch of provisions here and there. But legally competent in what matters, this act is 18. So the consent, which was the critical aspect, to be given for purposes of taking information, processing information, is 18. Teenagers are economically active, socially active, and so on and so forth. So the relevant consent for purposes of this act, in spite of these amendments, will remain the consent of the parents. Parents will need to consent to them opening up something on Facebook. And this, I think, is the difficulty we have. And perhaps Hank can tell us whether this language addresses that. But I would like to have a clear, straightforward provision that, like the provisions on abortion, makes an otherwise incompetent person competent to give consent at the age of 16, or the provision on sexual conduct, the consent is 14. So I would like to have a provision that says, for purpose of expressing consent, for purposes of this act, the age is 14. So that the 14-year-old can express consent. Otherwise, you disempower teenagers from entering and maintaining a number of transactions in which they are engaged on a daily basis.
Chief, we appreciate the comments. Our argument when we drafted this was that it's strictly speaking, well, that is what we thought, not necessary to refer to consent. If you take the example that a 16-year-old person is allowed to open his or her own bank account, now it is implied that your personal information will be processed. You have the power, in other words, you are legally competent to open a bank account, and so strictly related to that transaction is the processing of your personal information. That, in our view, it was not necessary to place the emphasis on the consent to process your personal information, but rather to use the wider requirement that if you are competent to transact or to take any decision which relate to yourself, that you will have the power, or you will be competent to consent.
This statement, Mr. Chairman, if I may. My understanding is that in order for a minor of the age of 16, in order to open a bank account, either parental consent is required or there is a piece of legislation which enables him or her to do so. Am I correct?
That is correct, yes.
Okay. So, in this, it goes back to the child in the absence of parental consent, the teenager in the absence of parental consent, or in the absence of a piece of legislation enabling him or her to do so, being legally unable to express a valid consent. And what I would want is for them to be able to express a valid consent. These are people who are all over the place, are up and coming, they are engaged in giving their information out of any moment, and we need to protect them. The consent from their parents is not relevant, it's not appropriate, and it's a violation of their own privacy. I told the committee the last time that throughout American and European jurisprudence, it has been recognized that a child has a right to privacy utilizable vis-à-vis their own parents. The child has the right not to disclose to the parents what the child is doing and to close the door. And when I'm talking about child, I'm talking about a teenager. And that must be respected. So I think that this is a very important segment of our population which has clear expectations, which, to which I think we should be sensitive. And if you're not sensitive, we will approach them during the election and tell them so.
Okay, just hang on there. A number of hands.
But just to Dean Nodaug. Before I give all the hands, are we not arguing about this in the wrong section? 25 is the sort of introductory clause, and then the rest of it is spelt out elsewhere. So should 25, and the real clause relating to children is the new 25A, okay? So should 25 just simply not read, a responsible party may, subject to 25A, not process personal information concerning a child, full stop. Because you're then going to deal with it under 25A, the competent and everything else. So I think you've put it in the wrong section, because you're linking the two.
Irrespective of the section, I think we need to have this debate, because if we agree on what I'm suggesting, then the proper place I would submit is to have a definition of child, where it says child is 18, however, for sure. The purpose of giving consent to A, B, C, D, child shall be a child of the age of 14 should be deemed to be an adult.
Yeah. We're going to get on to then 25A, which is the child section. But well, let's then maybe do that, because I just think under 25, under the old 25, we are arguing about something that doesn't belong in the clause, that it's covered elsewhere, and it's easier to look at it under 25A.
Chairman.
So can we proceed with that? And then I can't remember all the hands. Mark, you had your hand up, was that, but can we not look at it under the new 25A? Okay, all right. Take us through 25A.
Thank you, Chairman. Maybe just before we get to...
Sorry, just before that?
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to interrupt what we're dealing with now, but there were one or two submissions relating to the conditions that were made by the IT Governance Committee in the document, which I think we will need to go back to, relating to, I think it's 16 and 18.
Yeah, look, I looked at those. I didn't raise anything because I didn't agree with them. I think the best would be, because the submission has just come in, If the drafters can look at it. Look, there's one slight problem. I mean, I see it's dated the 30th. I got it day before yesterday. I suppose that's not too bad. I think if you can look at it and we deal with that at another meeting rather than now, because I'm otherwise one's ending up sort of thinking on the hop, as it were. You wanted to.
It was entirely our intention. We didn't. We just wanted to get it in now, so that it wasn't. We realised there wasn't much time. Thank you.
Okay, 25A. Oh, sorry. Before you got onto 25A, you wanted to deal with two.
Yes, Jay. Yes. Sub two then it deals with or defines what is special information of data subjects who are then not children. Children in the limited meaning of one. So in other words, a person, 16-year-old, whatever, will also be included here. The only real issue here, Mr. Chair, was the whole issue of genetic data. We now propose, in line with the Australian Act, because the Australians did a similar thing in their legislation. You will recall that Ananda previously, at previous meeting, referred to the Australian Law Reform Commission's report dealing with the human genetic data. But we propose now that health information should include then, just to stipulate or make it clear, human genetic material, in order for it to be handled under the clause dealing with health information, but then also to say that there is human genetic material that will be used for purposes other than health purposes, and that will be dealt with under the general clause, clause 25A. Clause 25A, Mr. Chair, and...
Okay, yeah. I mean, look, the... It was this thing with health including human genetic material. Human genetic material other than for health purposes. I mean, it's a bit, for want of a better English word, lump.
Chair, Chair, it makes for difficult reading, I agree fully. And the option that we have is to split subclause 2 up into a list, A to F or whatever it is, maybe just to make it clear that there is a difference between the two terms. And possibly we would like to recommend that, Chair.
Mr. Chairman, what is the difference between human genetic material and human genetic material older than for health purposes, older than human genetic material being human genetic material for health purposes only, and in which case why would we not want to have it exempted? I mean, why would we not want to have it covered in the health is covered? I mean, we're identifying what is sensitive here. And health is sensitive, so human genetic material for health purposes, it's very sensitive. If you are genetically flawed, Mr. Chairman, you want to keep it for yourself. And
I can think of lots of things to say to you about that one, but I won't.
It's an example.
Limited only to health, including
genetics. No, I understand, and this is fine.
Okay,
I think all we need is human genetic material, and that's all. It seems to me that the second one, it's either redundant or it creates a category which is covered under health.
Let me ask. It's a similar thing. Maybe rephrasing it. The following responsible party may not process personal information concerning health, comma, human genetic material, comma, sexual life or criminal behavior.
Yeah.
And why do you have to have human genetic material in one and then in another? It's a category on its own. It might overlap as sexual life does. Sexual life could deal with some health issues. You could have STDs. And it relates to your sexual life, but it also relates to your health. So what I'm trying to ask then is why do you want this sort of contorted? The key thing was changing the word genetic data, so it's changed to human genetic material, which I hope is right. I don't understand these terms, but should it not just be health, comma, one category, second category, human genetic material? Third category then is sexual life. Have you looked at that? Sure, they all overlap. Well, some of them may overlap.
Yes, I don't think it will change the content if you do it like that. It's just it will be actually. I know it reads difficult, but it's actually more clearer in the sense that you then know that health also includes the genetic data, because it actually comes in where. The two things must always be read together. You have the prohibition and you have the exemption, and there are specific exemptions for health, and there are now other exemptions for purely genetic data, because only the general exemption is applicable to genetic material which is not health, whereas you've got the specific exemption that's applicable to health, to genetic material which is health. So there are two different exemptions applicable to the different two different kinds of genetic material, but I don't think it will cause a problem if you do it, if you think it will read easier, but you will still have that distinction.
Where does that come in?
Look, you have the prohibition, and then you've got a general in 25A, you have the general exemption, which is fairly strict, but then for specific prohibitions, like for instance for health, you have where it's more or less in the general run of things, you use the information, for instance, for health purposes or political purposes or trade union membership or whatever. Where there is a prohibition, but for the general run of things, you have these specific exemptions to make it possible just to go along with your business. But then you've got the general exemption in 25A that's applicable to those prohibitions that are not dealt with in the specific exemptions, and that would be then genetic health where it's not health information, genetic material where it's not connected to health information will only be dealt with in 25A. But where it's part of health, it will be dealt with in the usual way that all things concerning health is being dealt with. So it's two different exemptions. No, the genetic information that's not health information. Look, the exemption on health information, we have the prohibition specifically for genetic data. Then there are two exemptions. The one is the general exemption in 25A, that will be applicable to genetic information that's not health information. And then you have the health exemption, which will deal with genetic information that's health information. So,
the way the bill was structured before, the old 25 under 25B listed a whole lot of categories. Then each of those categories was dealt with. We've now brought in a new category, human genetic material. So surely we should then have a section on human genetic material.
I thought we must have understood each other. I thought we would do one. And you, Alana, referred to some studies that you could draw on.
The Australian study. But I think that the 25A is actually quite sufficient for genetic information that's not health information. The health information is specifically dealt with in the health exemption and also specifically in 5, personal information concerning inherited characteristics may not be processed in respect of the data subject unless a serious medical interest and so forth. So the genetic data for health purposes are dealt with there. But the 25A is quite sufficient. I don't know if there's anything else that you would like to add. If you have a separate section, what would you add then? Because it already says that you need the consent of the person, or it should be the establishment of a right or obligation in law or public law, or the regulator granted the authority. So it's quite strict. 25A is very strict. The exemptions concerning the specific prohibitions are a bit more lenient, because that is to make provision for the fact that it's being used regularly in a sort of regular setting. 25A is quite strict, and that is now the only one that will be applicable to genetic material that's not health information. So I don't know if there's something else that you would like to...
Now, when people, for the purposes of the detection, investigation, prosecution of crimes, use genetic material, just apply 25A information to that scenario, and the retention of samples, which can have, as we said last time, all sorts of deleterious consequences, unintended familial tracing, racial profiling, etc.
In terms of 25A, you will need the consent of the data subject, but you must remember that we have in our exclusion in 4, where we have the exclusion for crime and state security and so forth. So they will have to make provision in that for security safeguards and all of those things. But in principle, you need the consent of the person before you're allowed to do that, in terms of 25A. But then you must take into consideration sections 4 with the exclusion there.
In other words, we're back to the forensic
bill. Yes, that's right.
And they're excluded in terms of 4.
Yeah.
The purpose of which is the prevention, detection, investigation, or proof of offences. Subject to safeguards.
Also, Mr. Chairman, I want to highlight, which I think is necessary, but just to highlight for our understanding, that we, while the rest of the bill deals with information. In this case, along with other international examples, we jumped into material. So this goes beyond information. And as Dean says, deals with blood samples and the actual genetic material. But again, it can be terribly overreaching, because on the letter of the law will cover holding, you know, the parents who hold the hair of their children when they're small, umbilical cords. So very difficult to get the consent of a newborn to hold in the umbilical cords, and you're in a conflict of interest. And you couldn't have a Monica Lewinsky situation either. So we have moved into the field, and there must be awareness, and I'm not sure we are completely aware of the range of implications that this may have, but I think it's necessary.
I don't think you can be I didn't hear the response here now, but this is strictly speaking personal information concerning your religion, your rights, etc. It doesn't include physically body specimens, which is regulated in terms of other legislation.
Genetic material includes the physical aspect. If that's not the intention, I'm glad that you said that it wasn't. Then let's call it human genetic information or data. I mean, there are three of us who read it like that here. Yeah?
I think the answer is in the definition of record, because as we explained it before we started talking about genetic material, if you take an X-ray, when the X-ray is taken, it's not part of the act, but as soon as you have the X-ray on a disc these days, or on those black things that you had, as soon as you can have it in your hand, you have a record of that, then it's being protected.
No, but obviously
so the actual X-ray is not protected. It's the same with the...
But why would the... I mean, obviously in terms of the act, they would have never thought that the actual X-ray, which is a picture, is not covered. My X-ray... Yes, the X-ray is covered. So the picture is covered.
As soon as it's in a record. As soon as you have it... As soon as you can hold it in your hand.
With my name, yes. Obviously, the image itself, which can't be held in the end, the X particles going through my body are not things. But here the issue is whether and why would you not call it information or data?
I agree with Hank Shepherdson. The prohibition relates to the processing of personal information that concerns human genetic material. So that the prohibition relates to information. It's not about the keeping of genetic material, but the processing of personal information that concerns human genetic material.
It also fits in with the rest, because I mean, we are not saying the health information or union membership information. We are saying the personal information of your opinion, your health, your genetic material, your sexual life, your criminal behavior. But it's not your criminal behavior that's being, it is the information regarding that.
So if I had a collection of DNA from people, and I just put, no, blood tests from people, that would not be covered. The actual collection of blood.
The actual blood would not be covered, but as soon as you put the result of the blood, then it will be covered.
So if I take your blood and his blood, and no.
Maybe just jump while we're on this to the definition of biomedical, because I recall that someone once raised a difficulty with that, in as much as the way you phrase it, you call it a technique. Biometric means a technique of personal identification that is based on physical characteristics, including fingerprinting, DNA analysis, retinal scanning, and voice recognition. Now, of course, we do have to find the clause where it applies.
I think you requested us to change it to DNA data, but all of these are verbs. I mean, it's fingerprinting, analysis, scanning, and recognition. So it's because the technique is being referred to. So DNA data would be a noun. You know, it wouldn't fit in there. So that's why we kept it. It is because we've defined it as a technique, but the suggestion was that just that we change the word analysis to data, but then it wouldn't fit in with the rest of the sentence. If you want to do that, then you will have to do all the others as well, which isn't really, I think, necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Biometric is in the definition. And so is its application, which is personal information.
It's one of those unfortunate things that one sometimes has to use definitions to define a definition or to assist in defining another term. The word biometric is not found in the text of the bill, but it relates to the definition of personal information.
Yeah, I'm I inherently don't like this self-embraced approach to the idea. There's material for health, there's material not for health. I still don't understand why it fits into different categories, but maybe a section on genetic material may be necessary. I know you're saying you don't think it would be, but maybe, I don't know what we put it. But can we, I think we can just at the most flag it.
I don't have a problem. If you want to take, if you just want to say health, as you suggested, and then genetic material, that's fine. It won't make a difference because it's just a prohibition on that. It's actually in the exemptions that the difference is being made. So I don't think it will. If it's
then you've got an exemption for health,
and you don't have any exemption for genetic material.
Well, you've got the general one.
General, yeah. But your point was that no, you need to make it clear that health includes genetic material in case people think it doesn't, but would they? I mean, the other overlap one, as I said, as far as I can see, would be between health and sexual life. Because you could have sexually transmitted diseases, which are quite clearly health and would fit under that category. But sexual life you've just taken out entirely. Sexual life doesn't exist anymore.
Remember, there's always in the exemptions. It doesn't have a specific position. But you must always look at the prohibition is actually the important one. And I think that was if we can just look at genetic information first. I think the point that was made last time, which we accepted as a valid point, is that the genetic data should be specified in the prohibition. Now, I think that's the important thing, is that we now have genetic data as a specific prohibition. Then, if you look at the exemptions, it doesn't really matter. 25A is applicable to everybody. But then there are more lenient exemptions in the specific exemption.
Yeah.
It goes further than 25A. So the only question then is really, do we have a more lenient... Are there instances where genetic data is going to be used sort of in a run-of-the-mill way, apart from health, where we need to then address that specifically, just to assist people where they are using it on a day-to-day basis, and now they have to comply with the very strict 25A. So that's actually the... But I think the point was really in the prohibition, not really in the exemptions. The exemptions was fine. It was the prohibition, and I think that point has been taken.
This is under the very strict 25A, which it ought to be dealt with strictly. But if I may just revert to the idea of the material. As Peter said, indeed, the whole thing, we talk about information. But we're not talking about information about the genetic human material. Surely it's your genetic data or your code or your whatever that's appropriate. We're not talking about your... Surely we're not talking about your material.
Well, I can't remember the debate, and I presume there was one. I mean, you had genetic data. Why was it changed to human genetic material? I presume it was covered in the debate that we had on it.
Yes, I read the Australian Commission's, which is very interesting. One can just read it for your own sake, on the whole genetic issue. And they explain it, that you have a cell within the cell, a nucleus, within the nucleus, chromosomes, within the chromosomes, the genes, and then the genes consist of genetic material called DNA. And that's your genetic code of a person. So that's what they... Yes.
But they call it genetic material
called DNA. Or you can refer to it as DNA as well. But that's what they call it. That's what the genes consist of, is a genetic material called DNA. And that contains the genetic code of a person.
Yeah, but
So that was the wording that they used, genetic material.
Because the problem would be that's where Mario's concerned about keeping the hair. I mean, your normal meaning of the word material is that it's something
that's
material.
But the
problem is this is not our area. I mean, I'm very conscious of the fact that I'm not a scientist, and they may be all quite clear. And it, I suppose, then goes back to Mario's point of we making a law. Well, he wants to make a law for the judges and the lawyers. We want to make a law for everybody, but particularly the people. So we don't want a law that the scientists understand and the ordinary people don't. But we want a law that's understood by both and that's correct for both. Now the problem is going to be, is this not maybe one of the words where material is scientifically correct, but the ordinary person, I was going to say like Dr. Umbrosini, but I can't, but the ordinary person, as well as Dr. Umbrosini, that's it. That's a compliment. Would see material meaning hair parts, body parts, and yet the scientists will see it as something else. I don't know. I don't know if we can take it any further, but try and look at that contradiction. But we do want something.
European court used, but we must ask some.
And that's probably translated from the French, which doesn't help.
May I make a proposal? And I inadvertently thought about Johnny Clegg's words, where he said, possibly we can use the phrase "the ghost in the atom that makes it spins around and around."
Sure. Yeah, I think that will be very understandable. But can you look at it? Because I think then it, and under what it's
end up in profile, by the way.
Susan
always puts his finger there, but the further point was, it's still material, it's still not that outward edge. And it's probably going to end up in profile, but we'll ask.
Yeah. So all I'm saying at the moment is I think we just should be tagging it. The preference would be, I don't want to make, the preference would be that and Ananda, just correct me, I do think I'm a bit slower this morning than, we're going to have health, comma, genetic, human genetic material, comma, okay, so that it's not going to be the one linked to health, the one not linked to health. We're going to try that. If there's anything that comes up, come back to us and point it out. Otherwise, the rest stays, but there is a bit of a contradiction between what may be the meaning of the word human material, genetic material, what the scientists understand that to be, which is what Ananda read out, and what the ordinary people understand it to be. No, I don't have one. I'm just saying, look at it.
It's not profile.
Look at what say if there have been any European court decisions. What wording did they use there? Okay. Are we going to move then to 25A, and then we'll come back to 25.
Chair, under 25A, then the amendment proposed in paragraph A then aims to draw a distinction between the processing carried out with regard to the personal information of a child and then also the special personal information of a data subject. So the two scenarios are split there, highlighted. Paragraphs B to E will then be applicable to both children and data subjects. Paragraph F will only be applicable to data subjects who are not children as defined. And then you will recall in paragraph E, the committee also had a discussion with regard to various issues relating to the paragraph, and we are now proposing a slight change in the approach there, to the extent that we propose that the word scientific should be deleted because it's in any event not consistent with
the phrase being used in the rest of the bill, among others. And then also, maybe to draw a distinction, Mr. Chair, between paragraphs 1 to 3 to the extent that they shouldn't be read conjunctively, but that we combine the old paragraph 1 and 2 in one paragraph, Roman 1, and then disjunctively to that, the requirement that it appears impossible or would involve a disproportionate effort to ask for the express consent of the data subject. But then to make the last or the old Roman 4, the sufficient guarantees requirement then applicable to both, because we propose that that is an extremely important requirement to be applied in both instances where you do have the option of one or two.
Herman.
Yeah.
Okay, I've got the problem with the children and that stands. Otherwise, I'm happy with this. Thank you for having changed the ends into ors. No, actually, the ors into ends. And no, the ends into
and
ors,
into
of course, yes. But I've got a huge problem because this was not discussed. It came out of the blue on this elimination of the scientific research. I think the scientific research is way more important than statistical and historical research. I mean, I don't know why this has been eliminated.
And just explain on that. I mean, it's now broader. It's research, not the scientific research.
No, it's historical and statistical.
Or research.
Oh,
morning. Sorry. I'm in the same boat as you, actually. Okay. Can we just deal with the children? And that is then going back to 25.1. And the point I was then making, why don't you make, 25.1a is about, 25.1 is about children. A responsible party may, subject to 25a, capital, not process personal information concerning a child, full stop. Okay? Subject to 25a. Then in 25a, you have this whole issue of when they can consent and when they can't. What about putting it there, not trying to divide it between the two places? That's point one. Point two would be, are children not such a special category that they require their own section? It's a broad question I'm asking. Okay.
First, to determine how we're going to deal with children.
Yeah.
If we go the way I humbly suggest, then there is much greater need to have their own session, because let's have a discussion on how we deal with teenagers and what is the relevant, whether their consent is relevant. I mean, a teenager can give legally relevant consent for sexual activities, 16 for abortion, etc., etc., but it can't give relevant consent to open a Facebook account.
I think one is just just the substance and how the drafting was done, because maybe the drafting has not given, you know, a good picture of what substance is supposed to be. What we wanted to do was to say that we're not changing anything. So that's why we did not go the route to say to give a specific age, or even to talk about parental control or parents or caregivers or whatever that you now have in the Children's Act, because a child may have two parents and grannies and uncles and aunts and everything and still have the ability to conduct some or other transaction independently, even though it's a child under the age of 18. So it has nothing to do with the what I would call the Children Act idea of a child and who's under parental control and so forth. Yes. So no, but let me just explain, and then we can perhaps, you can perhaps comment on that. The what we wanted to do is, in any instance where a child can do something independently, that child will not need to also not need the permission or the consent of a parent for his information in that transaction to be processed. So if a child can independently open a bank account, then he can also, his information can also be processed. If he can go onto Facebook, whatever, at whatever age, whatever, he can also use his they can also use his information. So we're keeping the position as it is at the moment regarding children, and we spoke to the drafters of the Children's Act, and they've referred us to a little booklet that the social development has drawn up where they've given all the different ages for all the different competencies, and it's a whole book full. It will be a whole book of all the instances where a child can operate on under what age. So that would be almost impossible to include in the Act to make provision for that. Why we included it here, we first had the first draft that we did actually did have the definition of child with this already in the definition section. But what we have here is we've got a child is a person under the age of 18 years. That's in terms of the definition. And then we make a distinction in 25.1, and that's why I'm a bit worried about taking it out of 25.1. We make the distinction between, we're now talking about all children under the age of 18, but we make the distinction between those children that can actually act in a specific instance independently and those children who can't. And then the children who need permission to transact also need permission to process the information. So they are dealt with in 25A1 in the 25A exemption. But the children who do not need the children, they are still under 18, but they do not need the permission of a parent to do something. That's, for instance, the ones that you say they are going to open up a bank account and they're allowed to do that. They are just being dealt with in the rest of the exemptions, insofar as everything is concerned that may be applicable to them. So we make a distinction in 25A1, and I'm just worried that we may lose that if we take it out, if we take this little explanation out there, because it's children who can act on their own and children who can't act on their own, although all the children that you're talking about are under 18.
Can I just react to that? Okay, no, just because, I mean, I think it's important we understand one another. I understand that. Let's go back, simple things. Age of majority, 18. It reduced by law for a variety of reasons. When it's not reduced by law, it stands at 18. Another argument is that wherever it is reduced, that reduction will carry into given consent. Fine, accepted. Your information about abortion, you can give consent on it being used at the age of 16 because you can give consent to your abortion 16. Fine. The bulk of transactions remains at the age of 18. There is no legislation which enables a child to open a Facebook account at the age of 17 and a half without parental consent. So this is what I'm trying to address to. And in respect of these, which are almost the residual power, are the residual areas of activity, I think we should make a consent provision from 14 to 18.
I think with Mario, maybe you're better off drafting a separate option, which we can look at, because I think that we're not necessarily on the same page in terms of what's intended, and maybe that's the solution. And so, Mario, I don't know if you did one in your original, but maybe to link with Henk and Ananda on a separate option. Then in terms of the framework here, my concern is the wording of 25(1). I don't like it. Under any circumstances where a child is legally incompetent without the assistance of a competent person to take any decision, action or decision in respect of any matter concerning the child. Is there such a thing as legal incompetence? I mean, there's legal competence, but does it get used as, does the reverse get used of legal incompetence? I don't know. I'm asking. You're declared legally competent, but is there such a thing as legal incompetence? So I'm not sure if that's you're introducing a new topic. So to me, because this is linking to 25A, the new 25 capital A, I then thought you could shove everything into 25A. I hear the points that Ananda is saying, and I agree with them. I think it's just a drafting issue. That's all. I don't think there's any content disagreement between myself and Ananda, but it's more a drafting issue. And I just did find 25.1A a bit contorted, and I'm worried about this concept that you've got of legal incompetence. So that's the main issue. And then I suppose it's a question of, the question still stands, would it make it easier reading if there's a section specifically on children? But I then had Mark and then in front of you.
Mr. Chairman, I think just coming back to this issue of the age, one of the reasons that this has actually come into this Act is because I've done quite a lot of work with Child Online and schools, etc., and the issues around electronic communications generally and the collection of personal information of children had come up, and the abuses around it. Now, the problem that we have, I think, is that while in a lot of instances there might be ages of consent which are less than the statutory 18 years, we are also in a situation where a lot of the information which is being processed by people who are not subject to any regulation. So the whole Facebook dispute, for instance, at this stage is in point. And yes, there are all sorts of issues around enforcement and policing and whether the processing is done domestically or outside of our country, etc. But the fact remains that increasingly there is a feeling that what is being done is a lot of information is being harvested from children, not for use now, for use in 10 years, 15 years' time, where these people are just simply not being regulated in any way. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg is 26 years old. He certainly makes, he's the founder of Facebook. He makes Mark Shuttleworth really look like a pauper insofar as what he's earned out of Facebook at this stage. But the problem is an international problem. We're already seeing governments starting to talk to one another about how this beast, this monster, is to be controlled because of the information that is being gathered. So I know, and in fact in the United States, the Child Online Protection Act, the age is 13. That is being questioned. And part of it is just simply because we are allowing children who do not understand the consequences of what they are doing to provide information openly, and that information will be used in the future. So I'm not here to determine what age is the correct age. I think it's difficult to make that decision. But certainly I would prefer to err on the side of the age being at the upper extremes rather than the lower extremes. That's the first point that I make. The second point is simply that if we are to assist in other areas of abuse around children's information, we actually need to ensure that regulation to allow the people who might be enforcing and policing is in place to allow them to do so. As I say, I agree with some of the issues around the wording, and possibly that can be streamlined and made a bit more elegant. But at the end of the day, we need strong protection for children, and I advocate very strongly that we look at it in that light.
Unfortunately, Mark didn't really help us. I mean, I think there's any disagreement. Maybe with Mario, I don't know, but we're saying do his own option, or he should go away and do his own option. But it's a question of how one does it. In a sense, you're arguing, I would have thought, for a separate clause on children, because they are so sui generis, as it were, indirectly. But it's the problem is how. So I think generally there's agreement. It's a question of how one does it. that covers the normal problem of is practically implementable, because you also don't want a situation. I mean, I just happen to have a child at the wrong age. I mean, the Sexual Offences Act and the kissing section. I don't want a repeat of that, where there was a sort of bit of an unintended consequence, and they made a meal of it. You know, going to be group kissing things because it was, there was a perception that it was unlawful, going to be unlawful in terms of the Sexual Offences Act. So one doesn't want a thing of it's unenforceable and we all then look silly. But Simon, you had your hand up.
Chair, I think the terms referred to are legally incapable or mentally incompetent. I find nowhere else that it says legally incompetent. It's incompetent, but legally incapable. In terms of euthanasia and stuff like that, they talk about legally incapable and mentally incompetent.
There is legal competence.
There is that.
Look, I don't know if we can take it that much further. I think that Mark, I don't know whether he intended it. The point I was making of should there not be a separate clause on children, would it not be easier if there's a separate clause on children rather than putting it into 25 and 25 1A where it can get mixed in with other things? I think that needs to be looked at. Not saying it must happen, but can you look at that? I don't know if you looked at that originally with the Law Commission and under, number one. Number two then, there is the practical issue of the wording really. And then I think let Dr. Ambrosini come with his own clause that he can then work with you, which can be put forward as an option.
And let me give you a final, what will be an unpopular option. But the unpopular option would be just to leave children out of this act. None of the European ones have them. It was a new proposal. I think it's praiseworthy, but we must be sure that we are not.
Look, I did note from Mark, I mean, if you spoke about the Americans having their own legislation specifically on what is it, children and the internet, I mean, that seems to be where we need to go. So it may be that there needs to even be specific legislation. I wouldn't go as far as Dean of cutting them out entirely, because it then just looks like we're not bothered. So rather put in something.
Sure. None of the other possible steps.
Yeah.
And we're just going to get deeper and deeper into, I was thinking while everyone was talking, are we talking about transactional information or just any information? And we probably find something.
And won't most of the European statutes be for Facebook or not?
Absolutely, I think so.
Anyway, Mark, then Ananda, and then I'd like to move on.
And Mr. Chairman, I think that it's quite correct that, first of all, as you say, there are lots of developments that are occurring now, questions that are being asked around what is happening with children's information. But this was introduced, it wasn't part of the initial scope of what the Law Commission was given, and I asked Ananda whether we could not include it as a clause. But it is really in the absence of other law, and insofar as America is concerned, obviously one of the things that must be taken into account there is that they do not have a general law of application, but they have many sectoral laws around privacy, and they saw it fit to have a special legislative instrument relating to children.
I think there are different things that I just want to quickly refer to. The one is, I think that the position regarding children is much the same as that regarding genetic material that we just discussed, is that the prohibition is in 25, and then the strict the exemption, which is fairly strict because you need consent, is in 25A. And then if you want a separate one, and that's really what I'm addressing, if you want a separate section on children, that would be then something that would be more lenient than 25A and regarding specific issues where children, you know, that would perhaps look at what happens in schools or what happens there or that or whatever. So I'm just wondering, you know, in that sense, do we really need a separate section? And if so, then if you could perhaps give us some instructions on that. The other thing that I just wanted to mention is that I think I did look at an offence in terms of what the Americans did in terms of COPPA, the Protection of Child's Online Personal Information, where that would look at children under the age of 13 years and the offence would be for an operator of a website that's specifically directed at children or has actual knowledge that the processing is from a child, and then that person must get the verifiable parental consent. That's what the American legislation says. So it is possible, we have a little draft of that, but if necessary, but that would be then something which would be stricter, whereas at this stage we are saying, you know, there's no actual age referred to, but in this case it would be only children under the age of 13 years that would be where it would be applicable, and that's why it would then be possible to have a criminal offence, which is a stricter, because the age is so much lower. Yes, it's 1998. So it's more than 10 years already.
I don't know if we can take it much further. I don't know if there's any... sorry, Cesar, did you have your hand up? Or no. I don't know if there's any instructions that we can give, because it's unclear. I think the general principle would be one, maybe just it was mentioned. We want stricterness rather than leniency on the issue of processing of children's information, but being careful about a repeat of the Sexual Offences Act. But when an under says, okay, if you have a separate clause, it might make it more lenient, I don't think we want it anything more lenient. But the point we'd raised before of parental control was more an issue of accepting the situation where many kids are not under parental control or don't have guardians through no fault of their own. But I don't think so.
I think he's going to prove to the webmaster that he or she is under 13. I don't even have an ID document yet.
Yeah. You see, yeah, and I think ultimately, the more I think of it, is this needs separate legislation that somebody else can do. You can go and, you know, this maybe, you know, we were worried about what's an under going to do when this bill is finished. Maybe you can research that aspect for the Law Commission, just given your expertise in this area. I mean, I'm sure there's lots of other area things that they want you to research, but I don't think we can take it any further than that. So basically, I think in short it is, you can look at the issue of, and again, from the public that are here, if anybody wants to make any give it any thought and make any submissions, look at whether there should be a particular clause on children, and then definitely the wording of the current 25(1)(a) with the legal incompetence is problematic. Look at whether it's just a blanket subject and then you stick it in the new 25(A). That was a suggestion I was making, just making it neater, but it doesn't have to follow that route. And yeah, I don't think we can take it much further, and then Dr. Ambrosini will come with his option for the 14-year-olds, 14 to 18-year-olds or whatever, because the problem is it's also a moving target, you know. So now you're talking of 14-year-olds, but in fact with the exposure and everything, the age of child involvement is just getting younger. So anyway, but he's going to come with his option. I think then, can we move, and I don't know then if you've covered everything for 25 and 25A. Okay.
Mauricio, and I've applied my mind to the issue. I appreciate the elimination of the scientific word, of the word scientific before research makes it broader rather than wider and narrow, because it eliminates a qualifier. However, I would suggest that we put it back and we put scientific and academic research, which achieves the same purpose. Because the word research, it's anything. I mean, when I can conduct a research in my closet for my to see how many socks I've got.
Not really.
Well, you know, research is not. We speak about scientific and academic research. Because semantically the word research can apply to anything. So I think just for clarity, scientific and academic research, no harm is done, and it makes it clear what it is.
It might not even be scientific or academic.
My worry with what Mario is saying is scientific, academic, what other forms of research have you got?
I'm sure, Mr. Chairman, you've read Proust. Well, you read Proust, the Search of the Lost Time.
We were under the impression that the objection was in fact raised against the word scientific at the previous move.
It's just that we are using it in four other instances in the Act as well. No, historical, statistical, or research purposes. So if we change it here, we must just then change it everywhere. In 14.2,
15.3E, 17.6F, and 25. So, yeah. Look, I would say keep it as the way you've got it at the moment, it's historical, statistical, or, and then these brackets, scientific or academic, closed brackets. People can see it there, but you don't have to take it as an option. It can be seen as something to look at. I personally prefer just having the search, because it's covered in by, I mean, not understanding the stocks or whatever else in the project. It's, I think, it's going to be excluded people from public interest. Very in the public interest in this project. Okay, is there anything else in 25?
Maybe just to highlight you, Chair, and this is where it becomes important now, maybe just to go back to, if I remember correctly, clause 10. We indicated earlier that we would just like to highlight that we might require a consequential amendment there. As far as 10.1a is concerned, the data subject consents to the processing. So, I think we will have to consider. Yes.
Okay, can we move in 26?
I'm just making a note. The committee has had.
Sorry.
Yes, the committee did have a look at the proposed amendment previously, and I think there was general consensus that the committee is satisfied with the proposed amendment. Under 27. We do not have anything except for a consequential amendment to refer to section 25.2 in view of the differentiation being drawn between children and other data subjects. 28, the same thing, the consequential amendment. 29 is the whole issue of expanding on political activity. Yes, Chair, and we've also footnoted or flagged Roman 3 under paragraph B. The concern was, or the question was raised at the previous meeting, whether it should not be deleted.
I didn't bring it with me. That's a problem with the Constitution.
It is in the Constitution, Chair. Chair, when we drafted it, we thought that it wouldn't have such a... It adds value. Political rights, section 91C, to campaign for a political party or cause.
Look, I think
keep it as it is. You can maybe drop the footnote for about the technical team raised the question whether it shouldn't be deleted. I think take that footnote out. So it's there as a proposed amendment at the moment. Okay.
30. Clause 30. Yes.
the amendments, the exclusion of sexual life, once again, as per instruction by the committee at its previous meeting, consequential amendment to cross-reference to 25(2) in both subclause 1 and subclause 4. Clause 31.
Sorry, just to stop there a minute. Is anyone here from ASISA? You were talking about an option under 30.
That was when there's a separate option 2, which is further on. We were concerned about that.
But
we're happy with option 1 as it stands here.
But I don't have option. I see under option 2. Okay, all right, thanks. No, no, it's on page 20, 26. What was that option 2?
Yeah, it's the based on the Australian Act where they have one combined clause.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Okay, all right, sorry.
Thank you, Chair. Clause 31, consequential amendment, and then a sub 5 to be added where a definition is provided for criminal behavior.
Okay, option 2 then on page 26 with the single clause.
Is there any taker for that, or can we leave it out for now?
We're not doing the voting attention to all the others.
Yeah.
It's very delicate.
Okay, I mean, it just seems in terms of the way we work, or the way our law seems to work, maybe it's because of us, we like the detail. So I would think then, unless Mario, you're following, I would think that then the option 2, the Australian thing, that's on pages 26 and 27, can then come out. It doesn't have to be put as an option to the full committee anymore. To make ASISA happy as well.
But Chair, the question is, will they make us happy with
carry on, sorry.
Thank you, Chair. Chapter 4, Chair, exemptions from conditions for processing of personal information. Clause 33, merely a consequential amendment. And the same in clause 34. That brings us to Chapter 5, Supervision. I don't know whether you need me to highlight the footnotes as well every time, Chair, but
no, we can look at the footnotes, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Not too many, and then anyway.
Yes, Chair. Thank you.
I'll highlight it for some
of you. Yes, Chair, maybe that we would like to highlight this. We just raised the question whether a name change would be appropriate. Chair, the word protection is a bit, one is always concerned that it might point to restriction rather than information. Well, it's not in line with the ethos of the Act, if I may say so. We're not restricting the processing of information to the extent where no one is allowed to process any personal information without considering any others.
Just maybe give us more detail. Where does this come from? I mean, the information regulated has been around for some time. So it seems to be extensive, law commission process. So did anyone under in that process propose this name change? I mean, my worry is just, is there information protection regulated? No, but just back down. I mean, but for me, it is protection of people's information. And it's protection of personal information. And I'm just surprised that something that's presumably been debated for a number of years is coming up. But another in the Law Commission?
I wonder if this is not also the question whether PAYA will be included, because if PAYA is included, then it's not only protection, the protection information, it's also an access information.
I had raised that again from the ANC side, there is some sympathy. I mean, I'd raise it outside the meeting. There is some sympathy for the regulator playing a or somebody to play an adjudicating role as far as PAYA. That, in other words, before you go to court, you can go somewhere else that's sort of quicker and easier. Public protector wouldn't be too bad for that, but the problem with the public protector is they only deal with the state, and PIA deals with both, which means that it's then probably only the regulator that could perform that role. Are they protecting, if they're adjudicating on PIA matters, are they protecting information? I suppose that's a question. I don't know. Hank, where did it, was this?
Actually, this is something that was also raised in the comments before the committee.
Okay.
Can I just put
something
on the record? It's not so new. I think, if I'm not mistaken, ODAC is one of those who advocated for the use of information commissioner or something like that. And let me just restate for the record that it is certainly our position that we do want this regulator to take on board the PIA work, because the de facto position is that we don't have freedom of information in South Africa. So I think there's a good logical case for making it the information regulator or commissioner. And let's not forget in this country how acrimonious this country is. Everything turns into an acronym. This is a bit clumsy, the information protection regulator. Even IPR, I don't know. I think it should be the information regulator or the information commissioner. And it's not such a new idea.
It would include the power of making regulations. It would register the fact that we're giving it the power of making regulations.
Yes.
And the commissioner is the need to have a commission, and it's got of a sort of.
Look, I think habits. I mean, it's because it remains in the bill, even if it's a proposed commission, so you can have it.
Now, are we on page 29 yet?
No. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Yes. Chair, clause 35, no proposed amendments. And then maybe just to explain, and we have a key right at the front of our document, but where you see a solid or a one-line strike through, it is something that emanated from the meeting that the committee had on the 8th and the 9th, as well as one solid underlining for proposed insertions. Where we have a double strike through and dotted underlining, that is instructions that we received at a subsequent meeting. So strictly speaking, some of the stuff are old and some of them are new, and I would possibly just then lay emphasis on the new stuff. So in clause 36(1)(c), the concern was raised with regard to remunerative work by the chairperson. The proposal is there, the chair. It's sort of more a redrafting or a rewording than anything else. Under D, on the next page, you will recall that we were instructed to provide for the members, the other members, except for the chairperson of the regulator, the possibility should be open to not only appoint them on a part-time basis, but to have someone, maybe all of them, one or two, to be appointed on a full-time basis. However, footnote 35 has been important for our purposes. If the possibility exists to appoint any other member on a full-time capacity, then we would like to raise the question whether they should also not be placed under a similar other remunerative work restriction, as is the case with the chairperson. And then possibly the easiest amendment there in that regard will be to, at the end of paragraph D, just insert a proviso to the following extent: provided that if a member is appointed in a full-time capacity, he or she may not perform or undertake to perform any other remunerative work during the period in which he or she holds office as a member.
Can I just ask on this one? I mean, we had the discussion, but we're seeing the wording now. Judges, the top people as far as neutrality, can undertake other
remunerative work. They've just got to get the permission of the minister to do it. No, even while.
Yeah, remember Schlope.
If they're going remember Judge Schlope, that was the whole issue, and the issue was had he got permission or not. Okay, so they can, and it relates not so much to the employment, it relates to the other remunerative work, the speaking tours and stuff like that. So this is a lot tighter, so they can, subject to the minister's approval. Here it's totally no. I don't know if it's appropriate to say subject to the minister's approval, because then they're going to, the question of independence comes in. Yeah. Although if you can allow judges to do it subject to the minister's approval, why can't you then allow the chair of the regulator?
Let me finish the thing.
But I because it's just that employment, performing other remunerative work is a lot broader than employment. And are you going to find people who are prepared to then be the chairperson or, I agree, I mean, what applies to the chairperson should apply to other full-time people. Or are they going to then be so demanding of how much money they want to compensate for the fact that they couldn't get any other remunerative work, take any remunerative work. So it's basically that. But I think the question I'm asking, if we allow it for judges, then is it a problem to allow it for the chairperson and the members of the regulator to get permission from somebody? If that somebody's not the minister, then who else can that somebody be?
I'm not persuaded.
But let's just bar them from other employment.
I'm not persuaded. John, the thing with the judges is it's a carried over from a different age. If we were to write the law today, we would not allow it. So I think that first we should look at the situation of judges. And there is no reason for somebody else to engage in remunerative work.
It is something in the JSC Amendment
Act. Yeah, no, I mean, we are relying on it. I think the problem is it happens internationally. I mean,
where it comes from is these sort of visits to American universities and things like that, which seems to be the practice. So I think if one then, what I understand, I mean, Dr. Ambrosini may not be in agreement, but if we understand is we keep it, on Dean's point. I think there's merit in having, the issue here is independence. We don't want them to be, it's not just the amount of time they're spending on the job, it's the independence. So it is correct, as we identified last time, to have performing other remunerative work, because employment is too narrow. And you could find that you're on a retainer for some company which is involved in data processing, and it's fine, because you're not employed. So I do think we've got to have it may not perform or undertake to perform any other remunerative work, but as with the judges, we allow for them to get permission to do that. Then it's recorded. Okay, JSC, the Judge Schlope issue of, was it given, yeah?
I'm sure that the JSC Amendment Act is going to force their police there. I think that's it. That they may, the only thing judges may do or make money from is writing books for the law. I'm pretty sure.
Does anyone know about that amendment?
Chair, I don't understand, but what I'm saying is these are the permanent people on the commission. If they're going to be working somewhere else, why would we make them permanent? We want them there all the time.
Look, that's the
employment issue. That was covered by saying you may not be employed in any other capacity. The problem is at the moment, there seems to be, I mean, the way things have developed, there seem to be people taking consultancies, people going to lecture at a university overseas, and then they get some payment for that. There seems to be a whole lot of that happening. And that's why this broader thing of may not perform or undertake any other remunerative work is being put in. And that's so I think it's correct that goes in, it's wider. But my issue was, I think I'm linking it to the judges, and can we check what the situation is with the JSC amendments?
No, but you're absolutely right, John.
See, so do you know at all offhand? No, okay.
I mean, what is happening in this country very often, people, as soon as they find a job within government or a government structure, begin looking for another one. Let's stop it. If one doesn't want to serve, they can find a job elsewhere where they're not going to be allowed to have a second job.
Let's see what happens with the judges and have the same dispensation that if the judges can do other remunerative work subject to the minister's approval, then we should do the same thing with this. If Dean is correct as she remembers it, and that it has been even more curtailed with the JSC amendment, then it should follow that.
I want to write something different but not unrelated. What is missing in the appointment section is a conflict of interest. Surely we need here what you certainly have in the case of Tata and anything in the telecom sector. But surely we have to say that that person or his or her partner, family, etc., will all interest in what would be the appropriate answer to actually deal with all of the sectors. That's why, but is there a category of investment or involvement that would constitute? And then we might either ask them to just divest upon appointment or say that they're not eligible at all.
I think, you know, again, everybody's seems to have investments everywhere. So, potentially, not everybody, but I mean lots of people. And you do need a conflict of interest clause, but it's more, I think, linked to disclosure. I mean, if the regulator's ruling on something that some company that they've got a major financial interest in is involved with, that's going to be a problem. So you do need surely a conflict of interest clause. I don't think you can say divest everything, but I think this aspect of conflict of interest needs to be looked at more. I mean, compared to say, what is the situation with judges? What do they have to do? Ministers have to put their interests into, I think it's a blind trust or divest or whatever. But definitely you don't want the members of the regulator to be involved in business interests that could put them into conflict with the work that they're doing. I don't think it's so much divest, because then you're not going to find people. It would be more putting into blind trusts or whatever. But the bottom line is, we don't know what we are talking about. Can they do some research on that aspect? Unless you've got any pearls of wisdom now.
I'm saying
the comparison aspect would be judges. What happens to them? You know, you've got an advocate, they've got substantial business interests, they get appointed a judge, what is expected of them to do?
You see, but on a charter you have an additional remedy, which is the motion to recuse a judge. So when there is a conflict of interest, that the judge is under the obligation to recuse himself, and that can be actioned by a motion. Here I think we need to have two provisions. One, that member of the regulator cannot act on any matter on which he has a conflict of interest. And that, just plain, don't act in a matter of conflict of interest. And second is that they must disclose any potential conflict.
But you see, that's it's sort of problematic in this case, because you have a single person who is a regulator.
yes, he has 400 people who are full-time panel, yeah? And he has some. But it's not where you have a full bench across the island. So, yes, of course he must be here, but it's too important to be a holding. You have to be comfortable to be holding. I think the comfortable thing is the now, that telecoms is right for potential corruption and and I'm not sure whether this is going to be so bad, but it is the better comparison. And there, certainly, people are required to not just to disclose, but they must have to go to indicate what they have. And it is often and certainly must be required, but they don't the blind trust is one thing, and you are going to be conflicted. And I mean, that is a multi-volume land sector, and you have to have people who have no interest who are doing the regulation.
Can you also look at what the international comparisons are? I mean, in a case where you don't have an individual commissioner, but you have a body.
She's found it. Does not involve other officers of profit or receive payment for any service. Does performing active service may not hold or perform any other officers of profit, may not receive the respective service any fees or emoluments other than remuneration or allowances, apart from salaries and any other allowances may be payable in its capacity as a debt. Provided that such does may be the written consent of the minister, acting in informal business and see payment. So see, normal piece of legal books written or written by that debt.
Okay, but have a look at the international, what happens elsewhere. Because then the other problem is, you're not going to like this one so much, Dean, the issue of the public servants being prevented. I mean, when we discussed that, this is not being members of the regulator, part-time people. When we discussed this at ANC, it was the potential conflict, but actually a lot of most of the work of the regulator is going to be with the private sector. So, you know, the key thing would be as many full-time members of the regulator as then you avoid that conflict, but why single out the public service? When you know the could be worse problems. So we weren't that happy. I mean, you have flagged this with pending final decision. Maybe different positions, but just to say from the ANC side, we weren't happy with two. The public service. Now, the problem is going to be money. We have put in this provision that in this provision, as opposed to anybody else, must put part-time their name. It is money supporting their name, it could be. But, that would because it's also linked. But definitely, if you have any other full-time people, they should be subject to the same restrictions as the chairperson. And then, I suppose, everybody must declare interests and refuse themselves.
One of the little thing about the appointment process, the chair is called constitution, so now they're individual appointments. And it might be expressly so, but there's no reference to a public nomination process. Usually, when asked that in some public participation, it was boiled down to the committee.
Is that not covered by the public? I mean, you see, the one problem I've got with the appointment provisions in our legislation is where they all start saying different things. And we really, I think, Parliament has to move to one system. Obviously, it needs to be a public process, but and I would argue it's in a sense covered by the fact that there are all these requirements from Parliament to involve the public. I would think if it were, for the committee to look. Can you look at that? But as I said, just bear in mind, please. We don't want. We need consistency in our law relating to the appointments.
participation
yeah.
check.
No, Dean's point is okay, if you look at 2D, okay, we're making it national changes. Do you ever find anything that is by both houses? No.
Yeah. I have, but the interesting thing is, my apologies, Chair. I must be honest with you. a select committee was created in terms of legislation, and that's the Inspector General for Intelligence Services. Well, that was the position. I got an example like that. But, Chair, what I wanted to mention is, and this is something to be taken into consideration, if a proposal like that is inserted here where the NCOP must be directly involved. I can't remember precisely which rule of the joint rules.
No, you referred to that rule, but the
proposal and definitely, unfortunately, my sort of study group was only for the NA.
No, I'm sorry.
So at this point, this committee, will the ANC members on the committee will be supporting on the recommendation of the National Assembly, not approved by Parliament. But the point was who was asking was 2B, whether there needs to be a specification in the legislation that the National Assembly must recommend persons after the public have been asked to nominate, whether that is necessary.
Look, maybe not, but what the sort of base provision is in the Constitutional 193,
and then a supporting vote of a majority of members, I think that's for everybody. Do you want to carry on then?
Right, sub 4, consequential amendment. Well, actually, just the rewording. The committee didn't like the wording as it was, so we just fixed that for you, attempted to do that.
That's my word.
Something that.
No, if you look at amended. Okay, we're back on page 29.
I just wanted to say that brings us to the short title of course.
Okay, fine.
Start chairing this meeting is really getting unruly.
Anyway, you're out of order.
Okay, Chair, thank you. The remainder of the clause, the committee already had a look at. There's no additional amendments there, except something which is a consequential in nature. Paragraph C at the top of page 30, we propose that it's not correct to refer to persons there, but rather members. Clause 36A. Is a clause that came, I think it was, yeah, it was 44. The interesting thing about subclause 1 is, I think it's, if one really has to be very objective and clinical about it, it appears to be nothing else than a repetition of what we already have. The question is,
do we agree?
Only one,
Dean.
Oh.
36.1.
No, one is one of those.
Okay. 36.2 then is the rest of, is it the rest the same?
Yes. Just consequential amendments again, the protection of
So there these things about the public service would then that would go back, the double lining one would go back, who's not subject to the provisions, because you technically then could have members of the regulator being members of the public service.
Yes, Jay, sorry, my apologies. Yeah. We'll have to take out this double strike through
again. Okay.
It's a bit difficult. We'll have a close look at this for you, because then, strictly speaking, is Parliament still involved in the determination of that specific person's salary?
Yes, because they are.
They might be doing. This is now a member of the regulator who's part time. They're going to get some remuneration for their work on the regulator, aren't they? Or not?
There are instances where we ought to have done, where human rights commissions have been stuck for decades. But these things we don't usually.
No,
no,
No, we appropriate, yeah. No, it would be minister in consultation.
Yeah. You know who does? That wonderful little committee that looks after Aaron's number there. He's the only Japanese in his own dedicated community. And I think awfully he doesn't go so well there. I'm not going to say convention to salary. But for the rest, in fact, I think it's the bottom of the
Look, look, you can check on it, but I mean, we do their budgets, obviously, and in their budget they come and say. But Okay. So minister in consultation with. Yeah, Minister of Finance.
Okay.
Carry on.
Yes. Subclause 3. I think that footnote is now irrelevant. In view thereof, that Parliament will determine remuneration and recommend that Subclause 3 should be deleted.
Yeah, the footnote gets deleted.
We'll report back on that one. Clause 38 deals with the staff of the regulator.
It's covered under
43. It's, sorry, Mr. Chair, it actually relates to clause 36. But yes, that is I think something that will have to be addressed in the bill itself, and that is when vacancies occur and how they should be filled. So, Chair, with your approval, we'll just insert the subclause.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, that's agreed, yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Clause 38 now deals with the staff of the regulator. The regulator must establish its own administration and assist it with the performance of its functions, and to this end, the regulator must appoint a substantially qualified and experienced person as the chief
executive officer of the regulator for the purposes of assisting the regulator, subject to the directions of the regulator in the performance of the financial and administrative functions of the regulator in terms of this Act and also in the Promotion of Access to Information Act. And 1B, such other staff as the regulator may deem necessary to assist the regulator and the chief executive officer, as the case may be, with all such work as may arise through the performance of his functions. Subclause 2 deals with the position where the chief executive officer may appoint a senior official as an acting CEO where the actual CEO is absent, and also provides that a member of the regulator may not be appointed as an acting CEO in paragraph B. And then in paragraph C, if that acting appointment or the absence of the actual CEO is for a longer period or a substantive period, then the regulator must appoint an acting CEO. And then subclause 3, Mr. Chair, the regulator must, in the appointment of its staff, provide for the advancement of persons disadvantaged by unfair discrimination, with the aim that its staff, when viewed collectively, represents a broad cross-section of the population of the Republic, and then subject to that paragraph, apply equal opportunity employment practices. Sub 4, the regulator may pay to the persons in its employ such remuneration and allowances and provide them with such pension and other employment benefits as are consistent with that paid in the public sector.
If I can just come in here from the ANC side, we don't have, in terms of the discussion, the whole issue there was around staff being part of the public service or not. We don't have so much of a problem with them being part of the public service. What our concern is that in terms of the independence, they must be appointed by the regulator. So nobody appoints for them. The regulator being the committee. So you can have staff that fall under the public service seconded, but it must be with the approval of the regulator. The concern basically was, I think this staffing issue is not as political as it ostensibly is. It's more what works in practice. And you want to avoid a situation, as has happened in some areas, where sort of independent bodies run riot in terms of pay and ratings and everything else. I know there is a thing here of you put in this clause of the pensions must be, commensurate, consistent with what's paid. But, there just have been so many problems. So we would not be opposed to the staff being members of the public service. We would just be specific that they must be appointed by the regulator. So where you've got the thing, as it was before in 38, the secretary of the regulator and such other officers and employees as are required for the proper performance of the regulator's functions will be appointed in terms of the PSA. The problem with that is it's not clear who's going to appoint them. So what we're saying is we don't really have a problem with them falling under the public service, but they must be appointed by the regulator. You might have to have a transitionary provision of setting the regulator up because I don't know. but basically that would be our view, and we don't want a situation where we create another monster effectively, with apologies to everybody else who might be.
There is something you need to think about.
Yeah.
And that is your quantum of your salary. You see, someone like ICASA will not remotely get staff that can do the work if they don't try to pay something even approaching private sector salaries. And even then, they have a consistent problem. In fact, all of the commissions do. Of the minute someone has been trained a little bit or has worked there for a while, they get poached. But this applies particularly now, and that seems telecoms is maybe different. But I wonder if some of our visitors might not have a an idea. I mean, the kind of staff you're going to have to employ here, some of them are going to be pretty highly skilled technical security people in order to spot the weaknesses in the security and risk systems of the people they're supposed to be in business. So I think you are going to have to find seriously big salaries for at least some of your staff, in which case you can't speak at a public service level. The other thing probably is not a problem. The other thing is a problem with and telecoms, where people get appointed out of the ministry, and that always means political trouble. Now that I think is probably here not a problem, but I think the level of the salaries is a big problem.
Mr. Chairman, I'm having some difficulty, and perhaps Ananda or Hank can help me out in understanding how the hybrid works, in having civil servants subject to a regulator who is not a civil servant. I mean, from a practical viewpoint, who signs the leave form? Who signs off on the cell phones when the approval comes from the Director General? How does it work practically, except if one has a technique of secondment? Now, if one has been seconded, then the chain of command, the chain of directives, the type of frame of references remains within the institution from which you have been seconded, which undermines the very type of independence that we are trying to achieve.
That is when the chair started talking about the option that we would like to consider now. I immediately realized that it's something that we'll have to go and research for you and see precisely. Because the interesting thing about employer, if I may use a personal example, strictly speaking, the DG of my department is not my employer. It's the Minister of the Public Service who is my employer. So there are things that we will have to check for you, Chair, and come back to you.
Can you have a look at it? I mean,
now, I hear Dean's point about wanting to pay them more money. Okay. I'm not sure if it is applicable in the case of the regulator. I don't know what the case with Britain is, whether there's a leakage of people from the regulator. But, you know, the telecoms industry is different in that there do seem to be far more jobs out in the private sector, so ICASA may have problems which this regulator may not.
Chairman, one of the concerns we had about this was appointing people who weren't competent, which is why we had that section in 36.1b, which was our comment there, that you have to include clarity on that they have to be, have to include at this point that they must be specifically capable of doing that. It's required level of specialized knowledge, as it would be required for the scope of information processing, etc., etc. Because we worry that you're going to get people, even if you're going to pay them well, they're still not going to be skilled up to scope, and then we're just going to have a bunch of guys sitting around paying each other salaries.
Yeah. So I think it needs
a lot more research,
and maybe to Hink, you know, speak to people from DPSA, because the bottom line is we want these people to work for the regulator, and not be employed by the DG of Justice, we're not creating another government department. So I don't know how it would work if you could look at it. Maybe if there's the possibility for differential pay, that's a good thing, but at the same time one needs to be careful that people then don't take the gap and go and pay themselves wide salaries, and then have a look at the IT governance proposals, because they've made quite a few on 36, but you've had a brainwave.
Yes, Chair, I did. And that's the one for the week. Chair, no. I think
page 38. Yeah.
I think we have the answer. And I remember it was done in ICASA. Now, maybe just to talk about the public salaries, public service salaries, and I don't want to name people, but deputy director generals, I think their salaries are quite potent compared to all over the show. So, and I mean, we're not saying limit to anything less than that. We can even, I mean, what we have here is, say, pay them a DG salary, but that on the side. What ICASA did was actually a very clever thing, because ICASA actually took up other existing bodies, and especially the telecoms portion thereof. There were civil servants there, and what they did was a transitional provision by indicating that as soon as you start working for ICASA, you do that with the retention of all your service benefits. You don't even have a reduction in salary. So, if it is possible to appoint civil servants, then, Mr. Chair, I think the solution lies in the fact that you have to have a provision which provides that if you are appointed, you become under, the regulator becomes your employer, but you do that with the retention of all your service benefits, pension, etc.
Resided in that ministry, and then when we created the first telecoms regulator, the SATRA, firstly there was a separate broadcasting, the IBA, and a separate telecom SATRA. And when ICASA was created, they were working. So you had a progression of people, but specifically the old engineers, the excellent old engineers who used to run CENTEC, and the engineers in the department went to SATRA. So this was between the history and the progression. And then eventually it's into it. And there's nothing going on. Yeah, I think you must have more fresh. I think that's a more fresh in the thing. And where a civil service is left under the employee, that would be a dump to employee of our
employees. Working for the commission. Yeah, well, you see the yes, but there's the only conflict that really comes in between the government and the commission itself comes up at the very sort of high level, but that's because the commission reports to the minister, and the government also reports to the minister. So the government advises the minister. So and we there are now public servants on this side. You know, at that level, there's sometimes some conflict of interest or whatever you would call it. Yes, but outside people. So on the professional work, you work towards your committees and the commission. But insofar as your admin is concerned, that's done in terms of public service. But at some level, somewhere there at the top, it gets mixed up. But I don't think this will be the position here, because this regulator is independent. So there won't be that problem. But what I actually wanted to ask is, I'm not clear now exactly what the intention is. Is it meant that somebody who applies to the regulator will become a public servant? Or is it the other way around?
We're not. I mean, from what I was saying from the ANC side, we're not opposed from the discussion before, there was talk about complete independence. We're not opposed to members of the public service working for the regulator. The key thing, though, that we want is the regulator must select the people and be, select the people, basically. So I think the issue is that you're going to look at it. Okay, we're not giving you much as by way of instructions. So far, there's not too much work for you to do. Yeah, that the ineligibility provision would come out, and then you look at what is the best system.
Mm-hmm.
No. That deals with the members of the... That remains. Is that correct, Chief? On page 29. On page 29, paragraph F2.
No, F2 comes out. You don't have a because there's there, this is part-time people. The point we raise is that you actually want more full-time people. Because if they're part-time, they're going to have a conflict wherever they are. Whether they are working for the state or whether they're working for the private sector, that's something you've got to watch out for. So we were not supporting the retention of F2.
Now, I support you in that, but not if the person is going to remain a public servant and go
this
part-time.
This is for part-time people.
Oh, no.
Then they would have to go as an option. I mean, obviously, where they've come from doesn't, if they leave it, doesn't, you can't stop public servant leaving. Okay. But this is the problem of our liberal society.
No, not for a minute.
But that one we were not, I mean, so you can keep two as an option. I think page 29, F2, keep it as an option.
Okay,
I want to start wrapping
lunch,
and I can see we're also quite tired.
Can I just ask something? You had a reference to the Epidemic Project, in which you were unhappy with somebody directing the work. What was it? You thought the CEO should be directing and you didn't want the regulator to be directing.
The regulator directs the CEO, but the CEO will not assist, he will direct the work.
I appreciate the concern. You know, budgets, funny things. You ask for $3 million to appoint experts. During that 12 months, you don't appoint an expert. You lose that money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
In any event, if you ask for that money from Parliament, we must remember that Parliament appropriates the funds. So, if it is understood that Parliament will appropriate money to the regulator which might not necessarily be used fruitfully during that coming 12-month period, then I think a provision like this can be omitted. Help me. Doesn't this entity submit a budget, get the budget adopted, and then can shift money from one budgetary chapter to the other?
Absolutely.
So it's not the only losing would be the next time around, if it asks for the same money, isn't used, whoever reviews the budget, i.e. we, and we usually don't do much about it, will query why we should give the same money again for that purpose if that purpose was not fulfilled. Yes, I'm not the budgetary expert of the department, but as I understand it, you're not allowed to shift your salary funding, and that's the. Chair, as I understand it, in terms of the PFMA, one of your requirements is that you're not allowed to touch your personnel, your salaries, or shift them. So it might be that you've budgeted $3 million for experts, you see that you're not going to appoint an expert, and you refurbish an office. You're not allowed to do that.
I know this actually comes from the Commission's, the Law Commission's Act, and I know that we very seldom use this because we use other. We very seldom use this because there are other ways that you can do it. But I think the point is that if you have your budget, you are spending your budget on the things that you budgeted for, and now you need extra, an expert that you are going to pay a lot of money for a specific investigation or whatever. Maybe quite a lot of money, and you don't have that on your budget, then you must ask the Minister of Finance for the money. That's really what this is about.
No, you don't need to do it. You just work like anybody else.
Remember, this is a may. May with the approval.
It's not must with the approval. Let's leave it for now, and maybe look at it again. I mean, you can maybe put a footnote on it, but change minister to, I mean, president back to minister. But put a footnote on it, and I think everybody can then relook at it. I'd like then to break for lunch. I think I've lost everybody. 2 o'clock though. What I'm told is there's lunch ordered for 20 people, and we are, so that does include the members of the public as well, so you can also get a lunch free. Preach, sure. It's in the old assembly dining room downstairs.